You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It's my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week David Carroll Cochran. He teaches politics and directs the Archbishop Cusera Center for Catholic Intellectual and Spiritual Life at Loras College in Dubuque, Iowa. His primary areas of teaching and research are religion and politics, multiculturalism and democracy, and the morality of war. And he has just authored a wonderful book called Catholic Realism and the Abolition of War, which I highly recommend and which we will be discussing. David Carroll Cochran, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me, David, and for doing the interview and plugging the book.
I am very, very glad to. It's a book that I think should appeal to everyone. I'm not Catholic. I'm guessing many people listening are not Catholic, but I think the book is enriched by its references to Catholic theory for and against war. Who were you writing the book for?
Well, that's a good point, because I think the arguments can appeal to Catholics or non-Catholics, believers, non-believers. I sort of work within the Catholic tradition when it comes to its moral reflection on war, but I think it's got the kind of principles that I intentionally try to write it for anyone who agrees with sort of general principles about not killing the innocent and peace and justice generally can buy into and agree or disagree regardless of their religious background.
Yeah, I think it does make a good case also for the influence of past Catholic thinkers on widespread theories of justifying war and
right.
as well as refuting those arguments.
Right.
You start out with the idea that I think I'm quoting, war's two greatest lies are its righteousness and its inevitability. Can you explain those?
Sure. As a pacifist and talking to people, the two big responses I often get, aside from, well, what would you do about Hitler, or if someone broke into your bedroom, would you kill them? Normally it's, well, you know what, war has always been there. It's always going to be part of the human condition, so it's foolish to think we can do without it. Objecting to war is like objecting to the weather. And the other one is this idea that war can be just because in certain circumstances it is necessary. So I don't like war, but if we were ever invaded or this or that, we'd have to go to war. So I think the two great things that people always go to is this idea that war is inevitable and war is morally necessary sometimes. And that's what I label these two great lies. And the book tries to disabuse those two great lies and show why they are, in fact, lies that war tells.
And without going into the same length as the book, how do you begin to make those cases?
I think pacifism is always accused of utopianism and of sort of this magical thinking. And I think that war, because it has such a cultural power on our mind, because it seems such common sense, it actually is guilty of a kind of utopianism as well. So partly it's just breaking down this mental image that many people have that just accepts war as part of the way the world has always been and always will be. And so basically the two halves of the book, the first half tries to show why war is immoral, why it's a lie that it is morally righteous or can be morally righteous, mainly because it kills the innocent. And almost any moral system, including Catholicism, says intentionally killing the innocent is wrong. War intentionally kills the innocent, therefore it's wrong. And the second and perhaps more interesting to me part of the book is this idea that war is not inevitable, that we can get rid of it the way we have other forms of institutionalized violence, such as chattel slavery or dueling or trial by ordeal in combat.
The strange thing about the inevitability of war and the permanence of war, one of the strange things, is that current war with current technology and weaponry, almost doesn't resemble war of 300 years ago or further back in the past. Some forms of ancient war look closer to football to me than to modern drone warfare. And yet you make the argument that it's not just modern war because of its technology that is evil and immoral. It's all war always was immoral.
Yeah, I think that in some ways, war today looks very, very different than it ever did with technology and drones and missiles and airstrikes and these kinds of things. But in another way, war has always been human beings organizing to kill each other. And throughout the history of war, civilians have died in as many, if not more, numbers than combat. You know, we kind of have this idea of maybe 18th century war with the two sides lined up in nice even rows and firing volleys at each other, but that's kind of always been the exception. War has mainly been about massacres and unrestrained killing on both sides. So I think that while there's an element, war is always changing. You know, when the crossbow was introduced, it was this big revolution, or when cannons were invented, the medieval fortresses that had been part of war for 1,000 years suddenly went away because cannons could knock those walls down. But there's always been the common element of war, which is human beings killing each other and innocent human beings killing other innocent human beings, which is the fundamental moral problem that I kind of try and identify in warfare.
Yeah, there really is a common idea among us peace advocates that war used to kill more combatants. And through the 20th century and with sort of a shift at World War II, it became something that kills more civilians than combatants, to the point where in recent wars it can be 90% or more civilians, as well as 90% or more one side of the war.
Right.
You're suggesting that's not really the story.
Not necessarily. Like colonial wars, for example, mainly targeted civilians. Medieval warfare was a chronic part of European culture, and more civilians died in that. It was the sacking of cities and the plunder and looting and things like that. And then, of course, war has always come with things like disease and famine. That's caused by war, and that has always killed far more civilians than combatants. So I think, yeah, civilians have always paid as much or heavier a price in war. It kind of depends on the conflict. So, yeah, some wars today, 90% are civilians, but there's the 30 years war. In Germany, for example, was probably vast majority of deaths were to civilians.
So to get around this argument for the immorality of war, you would have to imagine a form of war that hasn't really occurred yet in which civilians don't die, except that you make an argument that the death of innocents in war includes innocent civilians and innocent combatants. Can you explain that one?
Yeah, that's I think what I tried to make is the more difficult, perhaps, or more strange-sounding argument that when we hear about the death of innocents in war, we think of civilians, not combatants. But even the just war tradition, those who accept the morality of war, recognize the moral innocence of soldiers. It's why we don't execute them for murder once they've surrendered. It's why, once the war is over, we turn them over to the other side. Common ordinary soldiers are considered moral equals. That's the whole just war tradition depends upon, seeing them as morally equal and not culpable for the war itself. Why we say that an enemy soldier, even fighting, say, in the Nazi army, cannot do anything wrong. And in the Catholic tradition, I use the example of Pope Benedict XVI, who, as a 16-year-old boy, came from an anti-Nazi family, but was nonetheless drafted into Hitler's army at the very tail end of the war. And like many child soldiers, reluctant to fight but forced to do so, they're innocent in every sense that we usually think of the word. So the moral scandal of war is you've got soldiers on both sides who are innocent and not responsible for the larger powers that caused the war, yet they're slaughtering each other as pawns for these larger powers that start and fight the wars.
Is, in that sense, then, is a combatant who's, internally reluctant but obeys orders and fights and kills exactly as innocent as one who resists and refuses to fight and is executed or court-martialed or put in jail?
I think that there's different levels of sort of culpability. So I think the Nazi youth or the youth in Germany, like Sophie Scholl, for example, or some of her circle, the White Rose, would actively resist the war, refuse to participate in Nazism, and refuse to fight and give their lives. They're certainly more heroic. But I think that around the world today, there are children, people drafted, forced into war. And while doing so, while sort of giving into that pressure, it would be more heroic to resist. I think you can't see them as guilty in the same way as people who started the war. That they're as much, soldiers can be as much the victims of war as innocent civilians who are killed in the course of the war.
And yet defenders of war who think of war as sort of a team sport, as sort of a legitimate moment in which murder is okay, sort of think of both sides as participating on equal terms by mutual agreement and engaging in mutual self-defense, one against the other. You suggest in your book that this is not that self-defense is not a good way of thinking about people killing in war.
Yeah, especially because the paradigm we usually think of as self-defense relies upon one side having the right to defend themselves and the other not. So if you broke into my home trying to kill me, and I resisted, and then you killed me, you couldn't tell the police, well, I acted in self-defense. My murder victim was fighting back and trying to kill me. So war is more like a gladiator match, where if I go to a gladiator match in ancient Rome, I could say, well, both sides are fighting in self-defense, so it's just. But precisely because both sides are forced to fight to the death in self-defense means that gladiator matches are inherently unjust. They're the spectacle of innocent people killing each other for the interest of others.
So
far from making a gladiator match moral, it makes it, in fact, immoral, and I think worse than it.
And if one of the gladiators was overhead in an airplane, it becomes even less of a good argument, I would
think. Exactly, yeah. And much of the killing in war is not self-defense because it's very unequal sides. War often resembles more a massacre than what we'd consider a fair fight where both sides are a risk to the other.
In fact, you point out examples of massive killing in wars while the other side is retreating, in fact, which makes it even harder to suggest you're engaged in self-defense, right?
Right, much like the slaughter of retreating Iraqi troops in the first Gulf War. Often, some historians say the majority of casualties in war happen after one army is broken and is in retreat, and that's when the slaughter begins.
Hard to imagine a moral defense for that. We're speaking with David Carroll Cochran, whose book is Catholic Realism and the Abolition of War. You suggest in the book, David, that the fallback position for defenders of the righteousness of war is that, well, it's okay to kill innocents for a greater good, for a higher goal to which the war is directed. Couldn't that be a reasonable argument?
Yeah, that's kind of where my use of the Catholic tradition comes in, because in the Catholic ethical tradition, the utilitarian-type arguments are never justified. That is, on certain things, such as the intentional killing of innocent people, it's sort of a full stop. That's a non-negotiable, as some people might say. So the way I use the Catholic tradition is basically that you can't trade lives in that kind of way, that there's never any justification for killing the innocent. But I also try and make the point that that often is a faulty reasoning. That is, that's another one of war's lies, is this idea that it can solve problems, and if we just overlook the massive slaughter of innocent people, things will get better, and that war always overpromises and almost never delivers the very things it says it's going to deliver.
I might go beyond almost never to never, because I'm an atheist and a utilitarian and convinced by your arguments in your book, because I have not seen a case where war has accomplished some higher good that justified the slaughter in the war.
Awesome. Yeah. And I think war always, just war always says that we need to protect order and protect innocent life, but war is associated with such lawlessness and such slaughter and such, it always embodies the very things it says it's going to defend, which is, I think, another clue to why war has this hold on our imagination, and its lies are not so obvious because we can't see them, but once you open your eyes and see that war is the exact opposite of everything it claims to be defending, that you see the paradox there.
Yeah, there's so much I want to go into on this book that we're not going to have time for. People are going to have to read it, but I want to jump ahead to some of the analogies you make to other forms of violence and cruelty that have been done away with, because you do an excellent job of touching on some that many others, including myself, have written about as well, slavery and dueling. A couple that you bring up that have not been discussed as much that I know of in relationship to ending war, one is lynching and one is trial by ordeal and combat. Can you explain those as examples to the abolition of war?
Sure. And kind of as you said, you and others, going all the way back to Margaret Mead and even earlier, this idea that these other forms of terrible violence, which we accepted as just the way the world works, we can, in fact, get rid of or mitigate so much that we look back and say, how could people have ever done that? And I had a lot of fun with the Trial by Ordeal and Combat chapter because I didn't know much about it, and it's just these sort of crazy things that strike us today as very Monty Python-esque, you know. But for 1,000 years, that's how we settled judicial disputes, which is longer than we've had trial by jury, for example, which people just take for granted today. And it was very similar, like slavery, to war, that the idea was we have to do this kind of ritualized violence to protect the innocent, to uphold law and order in society, to ensure that society runs smoothly. And it was defended in very similar terms. It's a necessary evil. It should only be a last resort. It's inevitable. This is always the way it's been. To get rid of it, to be basically the equivalent of a pacifist, is dangerous because it will turn society over to bloodthirsty brigands, and law and order will break down. You know, suffer. Plus, you get all these sort of crazy practices of how society did it, and we see, you know, grabbing a hot iron or throwing people in water to see if they will think, or having them fight to death with these crazy rules that today. Or maybe in 200-300 years, people will look back on war and say the similar thing. How could people have ever thought something so crazy was reasonable or inevitable?
And how did it go from being accepted and required and natural and inevitable to being crazy?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting process that all these forms of institutionalized violence went through. It wasn't like one morning everyone woke up from a dream and said, we can't do this anymore. It was a gradual process of social attitudes changing, much like the rise of pacifism and the peace movement, sort of challenging assumptions, but also states reacting and outlawing it or suppressing it, and perhaps most importantly, alternative institutions emerging, so other ways to solve the disputes that were underlying. And it's important to recognize that many of these were also unjust, so judicial torture in many ways replaced trial by ordeal or combat. Just because you get rid of one unjust institution doesn't mean you've got a world of peace, love, and understanding. You can have other unjust institutions as well. Lynching, as it phased out in the United States, shockingly late, was followed soon after by the rise of a much more aggressive prison boom, sort of the prison industrial complex, so that black males in particular, as lynching faded as a threat, face now a new unjust kind of continuity with the prison system. So we can get rid of these things. It doesn't necessarily mean everything is great, but at least we can get rid of certain institutions. So a world without war isn't going to be a perfect world, a world free of conflict and violence, but I argue it'll certainly be better for having gotten rid of war at least.
No question. In terms of getting rid of war, and this is something that you address in the later section of the book, how do we end war? It seems there's the problem of actually waging wars, and there's the problem of the much more massive preparation for wars and fueling of wars and the international trade in weaponry of war. We saw the Pope, speaking of Catholics, tell a joint session of Congress to end the arms trade, and you heard applause after which they went ahead and escalated the arms trade, right? So
yeah, exactly.
How important is the arms trade and the preparation for war, and where should we be focusing in trying to end this madness?
That's a great question. I think that it kind of goes back to Margaret Mead's idea that war is an invention and that war can't just break out. A lot of people think war is natural. It just breaks out. But you can't have a war without a tremendous amount of institutional preparation for war. And part of that is the arms trade, part of that is the military-industrial complex, part of that is the mindset that people have that war is acceptable and a tool that can be used. I think it has to exist on multiple fronts. So all these, whether it's chattel slavery or ordeals in combat, lynching, all of it was a gradual process of work at multiple levels, by activists, by changes in government policy, by delegitimizing certain things. So as far as the arms trade goes, I think moral, what the Pope was trying to do, which is kind of a moral censure. With dueling, the most important thing that led to the end of dueling was when people, it went from being seen as respectable, being comical and scandalous. So far, the arms trade isn't something that is scandalous. You know, your kids going to work for an arms manufacturer is not something that parents are ashamed of necessarily. They don't refuse to tell what their kids are doing at dinner parties or something. So if it can become the kind of thing that's scandalous or shameful or just in ill repute, that's part of the social sanction that often changes these institutions, as well, of course, as government policy trying to erode it and shift resources in other sort of more productive, more humane, peace-oriented direction.
Isn't it a little bit ridiculous once you look at it from an anti-war perspective that murder on a smaller scale is absolutely condemned and lesser acts of cruelty from torture to rape to assault to fistfights are absolutely condemned, but the murder of massive numbers of human beings and the traumatization and the creation of homelessness and refugee crises is somehow just normal, par for the course?
Yeah, exactly. And that comes back to those lies of war that, you know, today we'd say someone who works as an overseer on a plantation whipping slaves is a terrible thing. How could anyone do that? But at the time, it was just another normal job that people sort of accepted as just part of the way the world worked. So identifying how you can gradually shift to where social roles that today seem legitimate, hopefully and down the road, will look back and say, how could anyone have ever done that job? How could anyone have spent hours researching how to more effectively make a drone that will more effectively kill people? Because drones just don't invent themselves. They're sane people who spend a lot of time perfecting these weapons of killing. And at some point, if we see that as scandalous, the same way we do other sorts of things, as you said, even more relatively minor things today, I think that will be social progress.
It does somehow become acceptable in U.S. society to look down on war and oppose war when war is imagined as something created by poor African countries, and we must go and liberate them from such backwardness. And yet, I look at the world of warfare and who primarily arms the poor African countries and who is trading more arms than any other nation on earth and who has put more into its own military than almost all the other nations put together. And I wonder whether the focus shouldn't, in fact, be first and foremost on Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think there's a passage in the book where I point out that series of wars that swept Central Africa around the Congo over the last couple decades, which have killed, you know, World War level of casualties. I think 9 countries participated, 8 of which were armed and equipped by the United States militarily. So we are, and this is what the Pope has pointed out many times, and his predecessors as well, we've poured arms into these countries, fueling the war and making profit off it. And you're right, we spend more than the rest of the world combined on arms and weapons spending. We're the largest arms dealer in the world. And that is, for some, paradoxically perhaps, one of the few areas of bipartisanship in Washington. They fight over everything except military budgets and approving arms sales around the world. Making that a scandalous thing should be a huge thing for peace activists.
And that war in the Congo of recent decades that's killed 6 million or more people was fueled by putting a warmonger in charge of the nation of Rwanda, which was fueled by years of U.S. support in Uganda and for the assassination of a couple of presidents, which led to a mass slaughter that the U.S. chose not to step in because it wanted that particular regime change. And yet we never hear not another Congo, and we never hear not another U.S. intervention that leads to a disaster like Rwanda. We hear the U.S. missed an opportunity for a noble war. It should have bombed Rwanda and didn't. That would have helped people. That's what we hear in U.S. culture.
Yeah, and again and again, there's this lie, again, this utopianism that war will bring peace, that that this invasion will be welcomed with open arms, and we're going to bring democracy here. And again and again, as countries collapse into chronic civil war after interventions, this idea that, and this goes back to the Catholic tradition, it's always said that war breeds more war, that conflict breeds more conflict, and that's the, what Pope John Paul II called the great lie of war, is that it's going to break the cycle of violence when, in fact, it creates and drives the cycle of violence. And that's what people call pacifists unrealistic and utopian. But the belief that war is not going to just set up the next war is as utopian and unrealistic as you can get.
I find another argument in U.S. culture just in very recent years a bit utopian and somewhat misinformed, and this is the phenomenon I refer to as Pinkerism, because Steven Pinker has been such a proponent of it, this idea that war is going away, and that if we would just relax a little and sit back, war would disappear because it's disappearing. And it seems to me he builds his case on much more solid evidence that other forms of violence are going away. And by viewing U.S. war as not war and recategorizing it as civil wars and comparing the deaths in a particular nation to the much larger human population of the entire planet and all sorts of fudging of statistics to suggest that war, when we've seen some of the worst wars ever, including the U.S. war in Iraq, that war is disappearing. I mean, if it were disappearing, I think that would be in part due to the efforts of people to make it disappear, and they ought to redouble their efforts. But is it disappearing?
I think, and this is an empirical question that is sort of raging, I think the evidence that the percentage of battle deaths, the number of wars is declining is pretty persuasive. Not to say it's not going to bounce back up and not to say it's an uneven decline, but I am persuaded by much of the evidence that the frequency of war and the percentage of battle deaths per capita has declined. But it's not an automatic thing. It's the kind of thing that has to be pushed. And as you said, peace activists, governments need to continue to hopefully drive the decline down even further. A lot of it now, as you're right, is civil war and conflict within countries and sort of that line between war and massacre and gangsterism. But great power war between great powers has been on the decline. And most countries are less warlike. Unfortunately, the United States is an exception to this, so we tend to export war out of our neighborhood. But many parts of the world have become places where war has become almost unimaginable.
There's no question that certain places wars don't happen, the United States, Europe, et cetera, and there's no question that the rich armed countries haven't gone to war with each other since World War II, and those aren't bad things. The problem is the wars on the poor countries and the wars between the poor countries. In any case, it is a topic we could go on for hours. We don't have the time. It's a wonderful book. Go and pick it up. It is called Catholic Realism and the Abolition of War. We've been speaking with the author, David Carroll Cochran. David, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It was great, and keep up the good work.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Chicago is hundreds of millions of dollars in debt, say the headlines, and the only question is which social services should communities shortchange? But is Chicago broke because experts say it is, or is there another way to look at it? We'll hear about the mirage of deficits from Chicago civic educator and organizer Tom Tresser. Also on the show, author, journalist, and media critic Ben Bagdikian, who died March 11th at age 96, was a founding influence on FAIR. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at The Washington Post and a dean at the University of California, Berkeley School of Journalism, Bagdikian was an early advisor and wrote the first cover story for FAIR's magazine Extra, based on his classic, The Media Monopoly. Counterspin spoke with Ben Bagdikian in August of 1995. We're going to bring you that interview on today's show. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. As the aggressive behavior of his supporters becomes as much of a story as the violence implied in his politics, Donald Trump is bringing together folks who agree on little else to denounce him. It's true, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz have policies in many ways even more regressive than Trump's, but then neither of them is openly pining for the days when protesters were carried off on stretchers. Turnout by thousands of appalled citizens led to the cancellation of Trump's Chicago rally, and a coalition of groups including Move On, Color of Change, and Greenpeace released an open letter calling for a mass nonviolent mobilization to stand up to what they called a five-alarm fire for democracy. So it might not seem extreme for Cokie Roberts, commentator emeritus at NPR, to say in a column that Trump's nomination would be a devastating blow to the U.S.'s reputation around the world. Nevertheless, Roberts' column was too much for the public radio network that many insist leans left, and Roberts was brought on Morning Edition March 14th to be admonished by host David Greene. Quote, "Objectivity is so fundamental to what we do. Can you blame people like me for being a little disappointed to hear you come out and take a personal position on something like this in a campaign?" Close quote. For her part, Roberts claimed to be a totally unpartisan human being who is just very interested in civility. When Cokie Roberts is your firebrand, things have come to quite a pass. This is the host who gushed to David Letterman that she was, quote, "a total sucker for the guys who stand up with all the ribbons on and stuff," close quote, meaning military officials, and, quote, "so when they say stuff, I tend to believe it," close quote. Which I suppose is just to say, keep in mind that some of the news outlets you rely on hold that being anti-bigotry biases your journalism. That's news you can use. Listeners under 30 might have been mystified at the moment in the Miami Democratic debate when moderators grilled Bernie Sanders on his refusal to disavow sympathetic comments he had made in 1985 about the left-wing leaders of Cuba and Nicaragua. It's been 25 years since the end of the Cold War, and younger voters may not be used to such loyalty rituals, invoked when a politician can be shown to have indicated anything but contempt for a government describable as socialist or communist. As Adam Johnson noted for FAIR.org, though, the condemnations only work one way. No one is ever asked to apologize for crimes carried out by capitalist countries, in particular the U.S. These are follies or blunders, while the offenses of socialist countries are products of an unmitigated evil that must be categorically denounced. Recalling America's past, Johnson says, one gets a line-item veto. LBJ's civil rights record, good. The carnage of Vietnam, bad. But when it's America's enemies, it's all or nothing. It's possible to have a nuanced conversation about such things, but that doesn't seem to be really what's being called for by pundits like the Daily Beast's Jonathan Alter, who tweeted, quote, "Bernie a lefty sucker for Cuban line on health care. If he got sick there, he'd medevac out. And where's his concern for human rights there?" Close quote. Well, Alter's principled concern for human rights was hard to discern when he wrote Time to Think About Torture for Newsweek. Some physical forms might be illegal, he conceded, but we could fix that by, quote, transferring some suspects to our less squeamish allies, close quote. Indeed, in Jonathan Alter's almost 6,000 tweets, this was the first time the words human rights have appeared. Finally, if you try to create the ideal moderate Supreme Court nominee in a laboratory, it would be hard to do better than Judge Merrick Garland. That's what the New York Times editorial board declared March 16th, describing Obama's nominee as, quote, "a deeply respected federal appellate judge with an outstanding intellect, an impeccable legal record, and the personal admiration of Republicans and Democrats," close quote. The Washington Post was likewise effusive, calling Garland unusually well-respected across the ideological spectrum, an ideal nominee in these divided times. And that seemed to be the consensus in corporate media. Obama has picked the ideal nominee. But wait a minute. As a candidate in 2008, Obama praised a Supreme Court ruling that affirmed that prisoners had a right to habeas corpus, regardless of where they were held, calling that, quote, "a rejection of the Bush administration's attempt to create a legal black hole at Guantanamo," close quote. But that ruling was a reversal of an appeals court ruling that Garland supported. So if you're glad that the Supreme Court rejected the legal black hole theory, why put another judge there who embraced it? As the SCOTUS blog noted when the former prosecutor was considered a potential nominee back in 2010, quote, "Judge Garland rarely votes in favor of criminal defendants' appeals of their convictions," close quote, often splitting from his more liberal colleagues. As many such issues now split 4-4 among the current justices, this means that with Garland, the court would often side with the state on criminal justice issues. Well, for many people, including many who voted for Obama, that's far from an impeccable legal record. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When Chicago financial officials declared last fall that the city was facing a 2016 operating budget deficit of hundreds of millions of dollars, media asked how Mayor Rahm Emanuel would face the tough proposition of asking Chicagoans to dig deep for the property tax increases presented as necessary, if not sufficient, to slow the city's financial slide and keep it from becoming, in Emanuel's words, unlivable. Our guest suggested instead that Chicago's dreaded ruinous red ink should be considered a mirage. Americans seem very accepting of the idea that we're living in objectively dry economic times and tough choices have to be made. But that tendency is precisely why it's so important to hold a light on what precisely politicians and the press mean when they talk about public money we don't have or can't spare. Because a whole lot of human hardship gets predicated, gets accepted and normalized on that assumption of scarcity. Part of what's called for is civic education, and that's what Tom Tresser does. He was co-founder of Protect Our Parks, a neighborhood effort to stop the privatization of public space in Chicago, and a lead organizer for No Games Chicago, a volunteer grassroots effort opposing the city's 2016 Olympic bid. Right now, he's lead organizer for the TIF Illumination Project, investigating the impacts of Chicago's tax increment financing districts, the sort of phenomenon that may be coming soon, if it's not already there, to a city near you. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Tom Tresser.
Janine, thank you for bringing me on your air. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're told day after day at the local, state, and national level that while we might want social goods like health care for everyone, access to healthy food and livable wages, sad to say, we just can't have them because the resources don't exist. That idea defines our sense of the possible and hence our political life. What do you mean when you say Chicago's claim of a budget hole of, I've heard, as much as $480 million, that's a mirage?
Well, it comes down to your opening statement about what is valuable and who gets to claim that. And it's a frame of scarcity versus abundance. And we have seen over and over again in America, when people in power wish something to be done, money materializes almost miraculously, whether it's going to war or, sad to say, bailing out our financial services industry to the tune of $14 trillion, that's with a T, dollars. And so that's the first thing that your listeners should hold in their minds. But here in Chicago, we have our particular set of grievances. So the way I look at it is there's three kinds of monies for the public here in Chicago that I think is relevant in other jurisdictions. When we're just talking about civic dollars, this is aside from what is printed in the mayor's press releases and his budgets. So what I'm looking at here in Chicago, and I think this is applicable in other jurisdictions, is money that's stolen from us, money that we shouldn't have to spend, and that's quite a lot in the city of Chicago. There's money that's hidden from us that we are collecting, but it's not available to the publics for the public budgeting process. And then there's money that we're not collecting. So unless we have a robust conversation about all those three, I refuse to accept the characterization that we're broke, that there is no money to do these public things that you alluded to.
Well, let me ask you first about the first of those buckets, as you call them, money that we didn't have to spend. I think for people in Chicago, here in New York, there's a particular thing that comes to mind every time the city's law enforcement are sued because of abuse or brutality. It comes up, you might see it in the corner of a newspaper article, but it doesn't really come home, that the payout for that abuse, for that lawsuit, is actually coming from us, from taxpayers.
Sad to say, the costs are steep. Aside from the loss of human life and the tragedy that the families of the victims of police violence suffer. But in Chicago, one particular police commander named John Burge, who's in prison now, but was torturing African-American men for years and was found out decades ago. But it took that long to work its way through the court system. And by the time he actually faced justice, he actually didn't serve time for the violence he inflicted on people. It was for lying and covering up. But the cost from his abuse alone is $500 million and rising. But that's just one part of a much larger, I hate to say, picture of thievery and incompetence and corruption in the city of Chicago. It's been estimated that there is a corruption tax in Chicago of 10%. That is to say, 10% of what we spend on government for the state, the county, and the city itself is probably over $1 billion a year. And that breaks down into what they call ghost payrollers, triple dippers, patronage workers, the son and the daughter and the cousin of the office holder, and outright thievery. So unfortunately, that is very present even in the post-Daily Chicago. And what I would say is what we would require for our public officials is a forensic audit, an independent audit on our books to weed out all this corruption. And we're not even talking about pension abuse where, you know, pension funds have been mismanaged. But that's one very large bucket right there.
And yet these are the sorts of things that are parenthetical or off the page entirely when we're talking about necessary budget cuts. Well, let me move on. For people who don't like the idea of the state giving things to people, shall we say, like direct assistance, the words economic development are sort of holy almost. It's one of those phrases that really means nothing at all in itself, but can justify a lot. I want to ask you now about some work that you're currently doing. Talk about Chicago's tax increment financing, or the TIF program. What, first of all, is it supposed to be, and then how's it playing out?
Well, TIF, tax increment financing, is a form of economic development supported by the state through property tax dollars that is found in 47 states. And it may not be called TIF where you live, but if you're taking property taxes off the rolls and giving them to a developer to do their thing, we're on the same page. In Illinois, there are about 1,220 of these TIF districts across 550 cities. So what happens is a developer wants to do a thing, a mall, a housing project, a shopping center of something of this nature, and he comes to the city for free dollars because she says that the market won't support me. The area that I wish to do this project in is blighted. Now we fall down the rabbit hole with Alex when we deal with this word blighted. It's a loaded term in modern America. Who blighted who, you might ask. But nevertheless, the statute in Illinois is very elastic and has allowed such areas to be designated blighted as LaSalle Street, which is our Wall Street, the Central Business District of the Loop, and the booming areas approximate to the Loop. And when a TIF is placed in such areas, it just means you're going to give free money to developers to do stuff they would have done anyway. And this is the argument you see all over America, where projects that shouldn't get public dollars but do because of someone has got an inside line with the mayor.
And it's an opaque process is part of the problem.
Yeah.
It's you can't trace where that money is going so easily, I'm guessing, by the fact that your project is called the TIF Illumination Program.
Right. Yeah. It's after the fact. I mean, by the time you read about it, you know, in your real estate press or if you're a city hall junkie and you see the agenda item that this is going to be discussed at the local planning body, it's too late. The deal is done. And in Chicago, there's 147 TIF districts that cover 33% of the entire city's real estate footprint that collectively, since they were born 1986 under Harold Washington, TIFs come and go. Some have lasted decades. The entire program has extracted $7 billion in property taxes off the table, placed we know not where. Well, that's not exactly true. We know where a lot of it went through the TIF Illumination Project, but the general public doesn't. We've done 45 public meetings all over the Chicagoland revealing the details, and every time we do one of these meetings, people are furious when they see what has been developed in their name. So you have a very pregnant question that is relevant to people wherever they live, is who's developing what for who? And has anyone ever asked the folks, what would you like to make your community a great community? As opposed to having a Walmart or Target or something dropped into your community being partially subsidized by your property tax dollars, which you have definitely not been consulted about.
Right. Part of what we're dealing with is the fact that we have differing visions of what a successful city would look like, what a healthy economy means. As you're saying, you know, healthy for whom? And it seems like a lot of the problem is the notion that public policy is a field for experts and that there's a kind of gatekeeping by discouragement, if you will, who gets to do politics, who's at the table. That, I'm guessing, is why you are a civic educator, to demystify the political process and to open up participation.
That's right. And, you know, when they founded this country back in the day, the founding fathers, I guess, if you will, felt that we, the folk, had to be smart. We had to be informed. We need to be about the public's business, which means having access to these documents, whether they're budgets. We are fully capable of being with our hands on the driving wheel. We shouldn't be always looking in the rearview mirror or getting run over by the car of policy, if you will, you know, the freight train of policy. No, we need to be very much present in all these dialogues about where our money is being spent and what kind of city we wish to live in, what kind of country we wish to live in. And so I'm for participatory budgeting process on a grand scale, where citizens can control the entire budget of their communities in ways that is pleasing to them. I'm also an enemy of privatization, which is a sort of a sister evil to the things that we've been talking about, is when you're strip mining public assets for private gain and we lose a robust public sector, whether it's public schools, public libraries, public parks, to the benefit of private interests who then get rich off of those assets. The whole thing can be found, folks, on wearenotbroke.org. And we haven't even talked about money we're not collecting, which includes a progressive income tax, a Wall Street tax, and a public bank. But if you put all those ideas together, it's a robust little 60-page book that should be hitting the street in the spring and summer in time to influence the 2017 budget debates here in Chicago. So we want our citizens to be armed and dangerous with civic knowledge.
The website again is?
WeAreNotBroke.org. The book is Chicago Is Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Tom Tresser of the TIFF Illumination Project. That site again, wearenotbroke.org. You can also keep up with the TIFF work at tiffreports.com. Tom Tresser, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's been a pleasure spinning with you.
Journalist Ben Bagdikian died March 11th at age 96. He was a crucial influence on Fair's work, not only for his classic book, The Media Monopoly, now called The New Media Monopoly and in its seventh printing, but also for the spirited journalism that preceded that work, including pushing the Pentagon Papers into print and going undercover as an inmate at a maximum security prison, and all the thoughtful, humanistic work that followed. He was a friend to us, and we'll miss him. Counterspin spoke with Bagdikian in August 1995. Here's that conversation. Welcome to Counterspin.
Well, I'm glad to be on it.
One ironic point about Disney's takeover of ABC to form this mega corporation is that ABC itself was created in 1943 because NBC was forced to split off some of its stations, those that then became ABC. The courts, as you know, forced them to do that because they were concerned about too much concentration in media ownership. What is it that's changed between now and then?
Well, I think that you're harking back to 43 is very interesting on the point you mentioned, but also because when finally ABC was an independent service, it was proposed to be bought by the man who at the time owned Lifesavers, Candies. And the FCC at that time, a very different body from today, said they couldn't be the purchaser because the purchaser had shown prejudice against unions and therefore would not be a good broadcaster because of that prejudice against an important part of American society. So that now what's happened since then, especially in the 80s and now in a headlong dash in this Congress, is to wipe out all regulation that protects consumers and, in the case of broadcasting, permits diversity and provide some kind of public service requirement for broadcasters.
Now, one question that we've been being asked lately at Fair, and it may sound very strange, is people have been saying, well, what exactly is wrong with so-called vertical integration? What's wrong with having the same entity control the distribution network and the programming or the content? What's the danger involved there?
Well, if you control the gate to the only well in town, you can charge whatever you want, or you can deny access to whomever you want. And if you have a water company that distributes water in the community, you let them in, and you then have something like a monopoly, and you can have the dirtiest water at the highest prices, and there will be very little choice. And so that's the problem, is that a monopoly or near monopoly permits you to control the quality, including downward, and control the price, including upward.
Now, we've also heard the idea that, well, in the case of Disney and ABC, but apart from ABC News, we're really talking about just entertainment. It's just entertainment, and who really cares if ABC is now flooded with Disney product? And what's your response to that notion that we needn't worry about it because it's really just entertainment issues?
Well, first of all, if it affects ABC News, what the Disney connection replaces or keeps silent means that there are some things don't get reported that might otherwise. But also, there's no such thing as just entertainment when it's on a powerful medium like national television. It is not just entertainment. It socializes. It is a major socializing agent along with family, schools, religious organizations, a socializer of each generation. And those entertainment values, whether it's sex and violence or compassion and cooperation, help form every generation's public values.
What about the concrete effects on news coverage?
Well, it remains to be seen whether Disney has some embarrassing corporate problem, which it has had in the past, that becomes a matter of public concern, and whether ABC reports it thoroughly and without bias. We do know that after General Electric bought NBC, that at one point when there were some stock ups and downs, the head of General Electric, Mr. Welch, called the head of NBC News, Larry Grossman, and said, "I hope you are not going to have anything on the news that will affect GE stock." So we've already had a demonstration that a big company with many interests, including nuclear power and so forth, own a news outlet, that they are very conscious that what the news says about them, the owners, can have an effect, and usually have not been loath to try to control it, either by individual items or getting rid of an executive in charge of news who doesn't remember that one hand washes the other in corporate life, and a broadcasting operation washes the hand of the owning corporation.
Let me ask you this finally, Ben Bagdikian. New York Times reporter William Glaberson, in a Week in Review piece on July 30th, said he was writing about the Gannett multimedia deal, and he said, quote, "Not long ago, sales of newspapers to business behemoths had journalists and critics anguishing loudly about concentration of media power in a few grasping hands. Yet Gannett's purchase of multimedia barely provoked a peep of protest," unquote. What's your response to the notion that these current media mergers are going on with no protest whatsoever?
Well, there are protests. There are protests by various consumer groups and others who are concerned with diversity in the society and in the media, but they don't seem to make much of a headline in the standard news, which is what notifies the public that there's a problem. So what we are increasingly... we're trapped because those who can tell us what's going on have a stake in not telling us what's going on or what its consequences may be.
That was Ben Bagdikian speaking with me 21 years ago. His message to his students was quoted in his New York Times obituary, quote, "Never forget that your obligation is to the people. It is not at heart to those who pay you or to your editor or to your sources, or to your friends, or to the advancement of your career. It is to the public." Close quote. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A jolt. That's what scientists are calling the absolute heat record set around the world this January and February of 2016. In just a minute, expert meteorologist and climate science writer Bob Henson will take us on a tour of the new normal. But hang around, too, for our second interview with Australian scientist Ben Hankamer. He's co-author of a new peer-reviewed paper that says warming will happen much faster than you think. To avoid going into dangerous climate change, Ben says this.
If what the models suggest are correct, then by 2020, we might have to have about emissions reductions of 50% if we want to stay below a 1.5-degree climate change level. If we want to stay below 2, it might be about 50% by 2030. And it really depends if you want to go down this pro-growth strategy or whether you want to carry on as business as usual. Of course, you can say, we're not going to do that, but then you have to also make the assumption that you will keep people in poverty.
That's coming up in our second half hour. First, let's get past the weather porn to explore another step up the staircase to climate catastrophe. February smashes Earth's all-time global heat record by a jaw-dropping margin. That's the headline at Wonderground, the influential Weather Underground blog. What does it mean? Is the new carbon-loaded atmosphere stretching its muscles? Is this the new normal? Or is it the end of normal? Joining us to talk about all this is a seasoned meteorologist, journalist, and one-time storm chaser, Colorado's Bob Henson. Bob co-wrote one of the most widely used college textbooks on weather, Meteorology Today, now out in its 11th edition this year. For more than a decade, Bob has had a front row seat as the writer and editor for Atmos News from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. His articles are published all over the world, and his latest book is The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change. Bob often teams up with Wonderground's Jeff Masters to bring out all the facts and figures about the strange changes we see today. Bob Henson, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, my pleasure, Alex.
You are definitely an experienced science journalist.
Yes, and I did do graduate work in both meteorology and journalism at Oklahoma. And actually, my original interest was in severe weather and still is, as you alluded to. So it was after my interest in tornadoes and severe thunderstorms that I became interested in climate and climate change. And that was actually way back in the 1990s during my initial years at UCAR and NCAR, where I was actually a full-time for 25 years before I joined Weather Underground a year ago.
All right. Now, the data on shocking new records that are set already in this year of 2016 that you reported on, that comes from NASA. Is that correct?
It does, yeah. There are several agencies around the world that keep tabs on monthly temperature. As you can expect, it's not an easy thing to do because we don't have weather stations equally distributed around the planet. So we have to basically analyze the data that we do have from thousands of stations on land areas and also from shipborne readings around the globe and to some extent from satellite measurements of ocean temperature. So all those things are fed into the mix, and several agencies look at those and use different techniques to come up with the global average. So the global averages are very, very similar. They're not identical. So sometimes one year will be a bit higher in one ranking than in another's agency ranking. But NASA was the first this month to come out with their global analysis, and it really was a shocking number. We're going to have NOAA's analysis later this coming week, and the Japan Meteorological Agency is also coming out with the numbers.
To be clear, those numbers seem to point out a global average temperature that in February came fairly close to the 1.5 degrees C, the supposed safe level raised at the Paris climate talks in December, not in 2100 or 2050 even, but almost right now. That's pretty scary, don't you think?
It is scary. Now, just some context for that. When we talk about the 1.5 C threshold, that was the ideal number that came out of the Paris Agreement. That's really, I think, in most eyes, considered to be a number that you would take on a multi-year average, or in other words, where we're kind of sitting globally in the long term, not necessarily the first time we hit it. You might think of an analogy to that as, you know, the average high in a city is 80 degrees in the summertime. Well, let's say in late May, all of a sudden you hit 95. It's not really the start of summer. It's just a blip, but it certainly is pointing the direction you're going to be headed that summer. So the global reading, in fact, was about 1.35 degrees centigrade above the average for February. Now, that's like comparing it to the baseline of 1951 to 1980, which is what NASA uses. So, again, you have to watch the baselines because different agencies use different baselines. The upshot of all this is that we're really spiking right now. We're going through several months of extreme global warmth. If we were to stay at these levels for the next umpteen years, then yeah, we would be very close to the 1.5. Fortunately, this is being goosed to a large extent by El Nino. It's going to probably drop in the next few months back down to a level that will still be warmer than we've seen in this whole century plus of human-induced warming. So we are still in some hot water, and it's still disconcerting how high it is. But we're still, I think, a ways, probably several decades from hitting the 2-degree mark that people are concerned about, the 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial warming.
Well, I'm a little concerned that NASA is using such relatively recent years. I mean, 1950 to 1980, the Industrial Revolution started at least in 1880 and maybe earlier. Michael Mann said that the warming even started before that. So how much does that add to our heating totals? Is it relevant?
It is relevant, and it's really a convention. I mean, you know, agencies use these different periods for different reasons, and then there are good reasons, but you absolutely need to factor in the earlier warming. So, you know, there's a little bit of an uncertainty measure when you go further back, of course, because there are fewer observations, but you could definitely add, say, 0.2 degrees Celsius to that, and maybe as much as 0.4. So the upshot is February was, I'd say, about a degree and a half Celsius above the average for February back 100, 150 years ago. Now, one other thing to keep in mind is that when we're talking about absolute temperature, February is a pretty cool month globally. There's a difference of about 4 degrees Celsius in the global temperature when you go from January, February to July and August. And that's a big change, and it's simply because there's a lot of land in the Northern Hemisphere. And land warms up and cools down more quickly than the oceans do. So the global temperature, if you were just looking at a plot of global temperature, you would see it a buzzsaw effect. It would be rising dramatically in the northern summer, peaking in the northern winter. But those are filtered out because the relevant thing is the anomaly relative to normal. In other words, this February is a lot cooler than any July, but it's the warmest February by far we've had.
The previous benchmark, one previous benchmark for high monthly temperatures was also an El Nino year, the winter of 1997-98. Did we beat that this year?
Oh, we beat it big time, yeah. We beat it by about a half degree centigrade, almost a degree Fahrenheit. So that's one of the most stunning aspects of the warmth this winter. The El Nino itself was comparable in strength to the one in 97-98. So the fact that we beat that one by half a degree is really telling that we're literally in a new climate globally. You know, the atmosphere is different. We have substantially more carbon dioxide. When you compare to what we had in 97-98, I don't have the number right in front of me, but certainly up substantially. It looks like we've added about 2 parts per million every year in the last, 18 years since then. So it's increased by between 5 and 10%.
I guess a lot of people are asking, can the worldwide warming we've seen come from just El Nino that develops out of the Pacific? That seems to be what a lot of TV weather news people tell us every day.
Well, certainly it's not just El Nino. I like to think of El Nino as being a way in which a warming planet expresses that warming. So if you're going to get record global warm years, they will almost always be in El Nino years. Not always, but usually. So El Nino basically allows heat that's trapped in the ocean to enter the atmosphere more readily because El Nino spreads warm water over a bigger swath of the Pacific. This part is an entirely natural process. So when there's an El Nino, warm water covers more of the Pacific tropics and is in contact with the atmosphere. So more of that warmth flows up into the air and the globe warms, usually by a couple tenths of a degree for a strong El Nino. Now, when we have La Nina, the opposite happens. You've got a shrunken area of warm water in the Pacific. So let's put it this way. The ocean sends out less heat into the atmosphere during La Nina, and global temperature typically drops. So that up and down is a natural process, but it's happening on top of this incessant drumbeat of long-term human-produced warming. So you can think of El Nino as being the spikes, La Nina as being the dips, and then these are all happening on this stair-step of long-term warming. So it's not all El Nino. In fact, most of the warming, if you compare it to 100 years ago, most of the difference this month is because of that long-term trend. But El Nino absolutely is the cherry on top, if you will, or the straw that's breaking the camel's back.
And I found it interesting to see from your article that CO2 levels, as measured at Mauna Loa, go up. They go up during an El Nino year and never come back down. Do we know why?
They do come up. It's a function of all the things going on in the biosphere. For example, when there's drought going on, there tends to be more carbon released, for one thing, because there's more fires, more forests on fire, and that sends a big pulse of carbon into the atmosphere. So as a result, during El Nino, there's more carbon poured into the atmosphere from the land and less during La Nina. So again, that's a kind of predictable effect. Again, the magnitude of that was pretty large this time around. This was the first year in 2015 that 3 parts per million were added to the atmosphere in just 1 year. So we're now right at about 400 parts per million globally, you know, on a yearly average. We're very close to that. Yeah, that's another very concerning thing when we have these big El Ninos. And we may have more of them, more El Ninos to come in the next 10 or 15 years, which we can talk about later in the program.
All right, yeah. You know, I remember Dr. Albert A. Bartlett of Colorado spent a lifetime teaching how important and threatening exponential math can be. That's where we get an increase on the increase. And as you've just said, that's sort of what's happening now with greenhouse gas emissions.
Emissions, yeah. I don't know for sure that the growth is exponential. There is some exponential component to it, actually. If you look, go back, say, several decades, we were adding about one part per million in the 60s. By the 80s, it was 1.5 parts. In the 2000s, it was about 2 parts per million. And now, this year, for the first time, it's 3 parts per million. So with the increment growing per year, it is a little bit like that exponential process. So again, very disconcerting and not good.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest from Colorado, meteorologist and extreme weather guru, Bob Henson. Well, here's one of my worries, Bob Henson. Every time the Earth takes another jump in temperature, a great number of irreversible feedbacks get a push as well. So we, just as you said, we might be going up a staircase step by step, and it only goes up. For example, what is the condition of the Arctic sea ice this winter as it's hot?
The Arctic is actually in a funky state this winter. Mark Serres from the National Snow and Ice Data Center called this the strangest year he's ever seen in the Arctic, and he's been following the Arctic for many years and researching the Arctic. I believe both January and February set records for the least amount of sea ice. Maybe, perhaps, I don't know if the February numbers are out yet, but anyway, it's been pretty much a record winter for the least coverage of sea ice, which was called extent. And it certainly sets things up for potential trouble this summer in terms of a very, very high depletion, very low coverage of ice. Now, there's not a super strong connection between what happens in the winter and the summer, because the summer depends largely on weather, especially the weather in May and June and the amount of sunlight that's reaching the Arctic. If you have a very cloudy period right when the sun is at its maximum in late June, then that can actually avert the worst losses of sea ice. Conversely, if it's very sunny and calm and clear up there when you have the most amount of sun, then that really facilitates the ice loss. So the worst case would certainly be if we have a sunny, bright period in June, July, August, and a lot of melt on top of this very kind of tentative state that the ice is in now, then we would then be perhaps on our way to a record low amount of ice. But it's certainly in a pretty tentative state for late winter. Some fair amount of melting going on already. And yeah, it's one more very disconcerting feature this winter.
Well, Bob, tell us a bit more about the remarkable heating that's happened in Alaska this winter and the rest of the Arctic.
It's been quite warm around the Arctic. For example, Anchorage has had one of its warmest winters on record, and it's least snowy. One station I paid a lot of attention to is Svalbard, Norway, which sits very close to where the winter ice progresses north of Norway itself. It's actually on an archipelago. So kind of between Norway and Greenland, a collection of islands. And Svalbard, the town, is the northernmost civilian town on Earth. It's at 78 degrees north, so way north of the Arctic Circle. And they had a number of days this winter that were 20, 30 degrees Fahrenheit, even 40 above average, and so 20 degrees Celsius. And on average, if you pull the whole winter together, the whole 3 months from December through February, they were close to 10 degrees Celsius above average. And very few towns on Earth are known to have had that large a departure. It happened at Svalbard a couple winters back, something comparable to this, even a little bit stronger. But it just reflects the amount of warmth that's been poured into the Arctic this winter. That was one of the main factors that pushed this El Nino above what happened in February of 1998. The February of 2016 warmth is really manifested by extreme warmth in the Arctic. A lot of the high latitudes, I should say, were more than 4 degrees C above average in February.
Well, that's a wow for me. Now, when it comes to the weather that we experience in the Northern Hemisphere, it seems like the jet stream is a major factor. And there's been a theory, well, really a series of reports by Jennifer Francis at Rutgers University saying the jet stream has been weakened by changes in the Arctic. What do you think about that?
I've been intrigued by the Francis theory, and there have been several other scientists contributing, Stephen Vavris from University of Wisconsin, a number of folks kind of pointing to the idea that the loss of sea ice in the Arctic ought to be having some impact on mid-latitude and high-latitude weather. And there is another group of scientists at the University of Washington and other places who argue that it's actually the tropics that are the larger forcing factor that would be controlling what the jet stream's doing. So it's been quite a vigorous debate, interesting debate, and I don't think the dust has completely settled yet. I do think the Arctic probably, and the state of Arctic sea ice probably have some influence on the northern hemisphere, but I think this winter has been interesting because El Nino has gone up and butted up head-to-head with the influence of sea ice on a northern climate. So the past few winters, we've seen a lot of cold in the east. Boy, one of the most dramatic signs of that, New York and Vermont in the winter of 2015, a year ago, they had the coldest winter on record. And to me, in a warming planet, that's really amazing. And it makes me wonder what on earth is going on. How could it be so cold up there? So those multiple cold winters, Dr. Francis argues, are related to the lack of sea ice and the relationship among that with the jet stream. So this winter, again, with the sea ice being very low, I was wondering whether we'd get another really cold winter in the Northeast or whether El Nino would tend to predominate. And El Nino tends to make winters in the north-northeast U.S. quite mild, and as well across Canada. So it looks like, for the most part, it's been El Nino in the driver's seat. It's been very warm across the whole continent, just extreme warmth. We'll have the verdict on the U.S. in a couple of days as to whether it was the warmest winter, but I believe it's going to be very close, if not the champion. And what's been interesting is we have had a couple of cold intrusions, very sharp ones. Boston had some of the coldest weather it's had in 40 years, but it only lasted a day or two. So perhaps whatever Arctic influence there is butting up against El Nino, it just got its voice in for a couple of days. But again, I do think there needs to be more research on this potential Arctic sea ice connection to the jet stream and mid-latitude climate. You know, the fact that it's been somewhat controversial doesn't mean there's not merit to it, just that it's sometimes these signals are really difficult to tease out.
So did this El Nino manage to break the long California drought as advertised?
In part. I think this is a definite yes and no area. What's fascinating to me is the deluges that El Nino has brought to the West Coast have certainly arrived. It's been very wet from central California north all the way to Seattle. But normally you would expect those deluges to be located more like along the whole California coast and then up to, say, maybe Oregon. So they've been displaced northward by several hundred miles. And as a result, you have some really counterintuitive things that have happened. For example, Seattle, which is normally maybe a little bit on the dry side during El Nino, they had the wettest winter in their history, on the order of 40 inches of rain. Meanwhile, Los Angeles, through mid-March, has been a little more than 50% of its average. So another dry winter for L.A., which is not good at all, and very much contrary to what people expected from El Nino. In Phoenix, it has not rained as of this recording since January, so a month and a half of completely dry. So El Nino has come through, and a lot of the effects globally have manifested. The one thing that really hasn't, it stands out like a sore thumb in the U.S., is it's been unusually dry from Southern California over to Arizona, even into parts of New Mexico and Southern Colorado. And that's especially been true in February and March. So this is not well understood why this has happened. It runs counter to most, if not all, the strong El Ninos we know of. And I just think we're going to have to research it, find out. One ominous connection, though, is that the area that this is happening in, the Southwest, Southern California, Arizona, is an area that's pegged to become drier this century as a result of long-term climate change. What we don't know is whether this El Nino is a manifestation of that or it's simply a one-off weirdness with this El Nino. But certainly in the coming decades, that area is going to face increasing issues with dryness, not only maybe lack of precipitation, but whatever rain they get is going to evaporate more readily because of warmer temperatures. So definitely not good news for the Southern California area, although they will get a water supply from the Sierra that's been replenished quite well. So that will help at least some.
So we've talked about heat records set on land, but it's not just there. Dr. Roy Spencer at the University of Alabama in Huntsville has persistently talked down the threats of global warming. He often interprets satellite data to find the lowest estimates, but even he reports the lower atmosphere is hotter than ever. Tell us about that, Bob.
That's right. It was actually February was not just a record on land where we measure temperature and where we live, but also the satellite estimates of temperature in the lowest few miles of the atmosphere. That region was close to a degree centigrade warmer than the average from the last 40 years or so, 30 years. So, and it again beat out the El Nino of 1998. So even in the satellite record, which has been pointed to by a lot of climate skeptics, climate deniers, that has set a record. So even Dr. Spencer said, quote, there has been warming. The question is how much warming there's been. So I think this is a, you know, maybe a little bit of a tipping point. We'll see. I do think we're going to be seeing continued warming, you know, in terms of the stair step. I'd like to pull the lens back a little. First of all, with El Nino, El Ninos usually last only a year or two, and this one has been in place for more than a year. So it's quite likely we'll go into La Nina in late 2016. So we may still set another global temperature record for this year, for 2016. I doubt we will in 2017. We will probably see at least a year or two of less extreme warmth on a global basis averaged. Hopefully people won't say global warming stopped in 2016, because that would be silly. In the longer term, looking, say, out a decade or so, it looks like we've entered something called the positive phase of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And that's almost like you can think of it as a longer-term El Nino, La Nina, you know, trade-off. It's looking at the whole Pacific, or at least the northern half of the Pacific. There's another version that looks at the entire Pacific, but it measures the tendency toward the ocean patterns that support El Nino. So with this PDO, as it's called, in its positive phase, as it looks like it is now, that would tend to imply we're going to have more El Ninos and fewer La Ninas over the next, say, 10 or 15 years. And if, in fact, that happens, we're going to see more spikes in global warming over the next 10 to 15 years in terms of atmospheric warming. After that, if we went to a negative PDO, which at some point we presumably would, then it might level out a bit more and we'd see a bit less warming. And it might be more like the decade of the 2000s, which still had atmospheric warming proceeding, but at a lower pace. So again, the two steps forward and then one step forward, that pattern will continue as the planet continues to warm. But I think the next decade, we're going to see some pretty dramatic rises and some pretty dramatic global records. Maybe 2016, and then maybe again the next time we get a big El Nino, which could be another 3 to 5 years if history serves as a guide.
Although I have talked to a couple of scientists who said, look, at some point in the 2020s or the 2030s, the amount of carbon we put up there is going to override these natural oscillations, as we've been talking about El Nino, La Nina. It's just going to be kind of unstoppable no matter what happens with those systems.
Well, I still think we'll have El Nino and La Nina on top of that rise, but indeed, the rise induced by carbon dioxide, the forcing is continuing to grow. I think the big question looking ahead a couple of decades is, will we get some nonlinear effects, some positive feedbacks? Arctic sea ice is one very strong candidate for that, I would say. The more the Arctic sea ice melts and the more regularly it gets depleted in the summer, that's going to absorb more heat into the oceans, and the whole global system will be absorbing increasing amount of heat. So, you know, who knows exactly how that's going to transpire once we get out decades from now. And part of that will depend on what we do, on how we act and how quickly we act to reduce emissions. You know, we do have the potential to reduce emissions a lot more than we have. Even with technologies we already have at our disposal with solar and wind, we could deploy those far more than we are now. You know, natural gas, for all its problems with fracking and such, and the potential for methane loss, it does produce less CO2, so arguably there might be some benefits to natural gas in terms of CO2, but absolutely with solar and wind, we can do a great deal. Obviously with efficiency, we can do a great deal. You know, regardless of whether we do massive deployment and that keeps us short of the 2 degrees centigrade threshold, whether we go over that threshold, to me, it's really the direction we're headed in terms of what we're doing that matters. And we can prevent even a bad outcome from being a really bad outcome by what we do now. So I think these benchmarks, these global records, are really important as consciousness raisers. I hope they're not demotivators. I hope they don't make people just shrug their shoulders. The important thing is to take this seriously and see that we have real potential for real trouble and that we need to act, you know, that it's not too late to act to make a difference.
Well, I absolutely agree with that, but I do want to go back to your article to point out that you note there have been some impacts already in this year in places that we seldom hear about, in Vietnam, in Zimbabwe, in Fiji, and I would add in the coral reefs as well.
Those are huge problems, yeah. In fact, those countries, three countries, Vietnam, Zimbabwe, and Fiji, all had impacts calculated in February that were at least 4% of their gross domestic product. So in the U.S., that would be the equivalent of, say, 5 Hurricane Katrinas in 1 month. So extremely devastating to those countries. Those are accentuated certainly by the El Nino. These are El Nino-related impacts, the kinds of things you would expect during El Nino. For example, Vietnam tends to be dry in El Nino, but they were extremely dry this time around. One problem with drought, and one of my biggest concerns, I would say, is even when you have natural drought inducers like El Nino, the impact of those is getting worse and worse because of higher temperatures. As temperatures rise, that allows more moisture to escape from the soil. So when you have a drought, even if it's the same level of moisture deficit in terms of rain, the impact is going to be worse because those warmer temperatures are sucking that water out of the soil, and that allows the temperatures to get hotter. And we sure saw that in California in 2015. Drought was on par with some of the worst of the last 100 years, and obviously extension of a multi-year drought, but the temperatures were simply off the charts in 2015. And that increment of heat is going to be a real problem, and it's just going to exacerbate drought starting now. You know, we've seen that with the Vietnam drought, with the Zimbabwe drought, actually all across southern Africa. Historic multi-year drought has been accentuated by this El Nino. Fiji was another place that had a 10% of their GDP hit because of Cyclone Winston. Now, the impact of climate change on tropical cyclones is still undergoing a lot of research, but one thing we do know is when water temperatures are warmer, that's more fuel for whatever hurricanes and typhoons do develop. And when they hit places, that's the potential for more damage.
You know, Bob, I find it so frustrating when I do watch TV, as I call it, weather porn, you know, the really exciting news about weather. There's just no background, the kind of things you and I are talking about right now about climate change, and it's part of it. And, you know, for a while, some meteorologists were loudly denying climate change. Has that resistance changed, do you think, or is it still a problem?
I can actually say firsthand that it is changing. I was speaking a few days ago at a workshop for broadcast meteorologists that was sponsored by Climate Central and the Yale Project on Climate Change. And that program has had real success the last several years at bringing weathercasters together to sit back for a day and listen and interact with top scientists and, you know, learn more about climate change, to express some of their concerns, things that they hear from their viewers, and how to address their concerns. And there's just been a fantastic dialogue that's developed. And I think the level of climate change skepticism in the weathercaster community has gone down pretty sharply. I do think there are the constraints that have always been there. Weathercasters have 3 minutes, maybe if they're lucky four, to cover the daily weather. And there's just not much time to provide that context that, as you point out, is really needed. I've been an advocate for some time of weathercasters having, say, a climate moment, even just once a month, to say, here's our monthly average, and once again, it's above normal. I think you've got to work that in as best you can, and there are weathercasters out there who are doing a great job of that. There's progress in that front. It's been a challenge in other areas. You know, network news did not cover climate change much at all in 2015, even though we had the Paris Accord. The amount of climate change coverage has been down over the last several years, and hard to say exactly why, but you know, there could be battle fatigue. You know, there are folks who are just tired of hearing about it, but it ain't going away. And again, there are things we can do about it. I'm very optimistic about the ability to reduce emissions globally. And it's a matter of global will. It's a matter of putting this Paris Accord into boots on the ground actions. You know, the agreement really was landmark, but it was a global voluntary agreement. And that means it's only as strong as people's and nations' willpower. It's only as good as what we make of it. It's the potential to be a great agreement, but you know, depending on which way the political winds blow around the world the next year or two, we'll just have to see how it unfolds.
Indeed. Professor Stefan Ramsdorf from the Potsdam Institute in Germany told an Australian newspaper, we're in a kind of climate emergency now. And that's the way it feels to me and to the scientists that I've been talking to, is that we only have a few years to get our act together and bring about renewable energy and bring our emissions down.
You know, I would agree that the sooner we act, the better. I think I tend to be someone who says it's never too late to have some impact, but there are conversely other things that are almost too late to change. But, you know, I don't think there's going to be an obvious tipping point in terms of how we experience the weather and climate. I think there will be a series of individual things, and those individual things may grow over time. It probably will grow over time. So at any point in this long process, this long slog toward a warmer planet, we're going to have opportunities to do more. And We're going to have continual surprises and shocks along the way, and whatever we can do to avert the worst of those is a good thing, I think. Sea level is one real concern of mine, and that's almost the definition of a creeping problem, because a few centimeters, you know, or a centimeter or so every decade, you know, adds up over time. And there are certainly cities along the U.S. East Coast that are getting what is laughably called nuisance flooding, but is happening more and more often. We had some of the biggest tides in history this fall in Charleston and Savannah on the Southeast U.S. Coast, and those were not even triggered by a major hurricane, but just by, you know, a moderately strong weather event coupled with a full moon. And it's very unsettling for that to be happening. You know, recurrent flooding in Miami Beach has been a real problem that's getting worse now and actually is getting some attention from policymakers. But Miami has no ability to build a seawall that's lasting because of the limestone substrate. So that's one of the cities that I'm really concerned about in the longer term. And we'll see that setting in over the next several decades. But in the longer term, there are real, real concerns with keeping cities like Miami and New Orleans viable. So what was nuisance flooding now is going to be progressively worse flooding, I think, in the decades to come.
And we can add a lot of Asian cities to that list. Well, cities around the world are built on the coast.
Yes, absolutely. Certainly many, many countries around the world and many cities are going to face increasing sea level problems. So we can learn from what they've done in the Netherlands to deal with sea level rise. In many cities, there is infrastructure improvement that can be done. In other places, it's going to be tougher.
We're going to have to wrap it up there. Reporting on extreme weather, Bob Henson is never going to be out of a job. He's the author of The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change, and he co-authored a Standard College textbook, Meteorology Today. Dr. Bob Henson is that rare combination of a meteorologist and a journalist. He's been published all over the world, but my favorite spot to find him is at the Weather Underground blog at wonderground.com. His Twitter handle is @bhensonweather. Find links to the stories we've covered in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Bob Henson, it's been great having you on Radio EcoShock, and I hope we can have you come back again.
Oh, my pleasure, Alex. Thanks very much. Take care.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Look out, the world may warm much faster than we thought. That could create an energy squeeze. It's all in a new big picture study from Australian researchers. Let's peer into a real future with Professor Ben Hankamer from the Institute for Molecular Bioscience at the University of Queensland near Brisbane, Australia. Ben, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Just the title of your new paper suggests great big topics. I mean, it's trading off global fuel supply, CO2 emissions, and sustainable development. What drove you and your co-authors to take on this research?
What drove us to conduct this research was to analyze factors affecting energy and climate security. Globally, we're facing some very big challenges coming into the future, and we need to understand these if we want to plan into the future. And one of these challenges is that our population is forecast to rise from about 7.4 to about 9.7 billion people by 2050. And to provide for this growing population, we'll have to provide more energy, more food, more water, and also reduce our CO2 emissions by 2050 by quite a large amount. So everything that we do is driven by energy, and the aim of our analysis was to establish how much energy we need into the future and what that means for climate change. And the study has implications beyond energy security as well. It has implications for our environment, social and political stability, because we need energy for everything that we do. So once we know how much energy we need, we can then determine how much CO2 emissions that will result in. And it would also tell us something about the dates that we lock into climate change of, say, 1.5 or 2 degrees C, and what we need to do to transition, say, to renewable systems.
Let's start with energy demand. How much more power will Earth's population need by 2050, and how do you know?
So it really depends on the political choices that we make. So I think the best thing to do is probably to break down this problem. The global economy is now valued at about $110 trillion per year, and that's a big number. And it's powered by a $6 trillion energy sector. Now, one thing that's perhaps surprising is that 80% of this energy is provided as fuels and only about 20% is electric. So while good progress is made to supply that 20% electricity sector, say through photovoltaic panels and wind and wave energy, that sort of thing, we have very few solutions for fuels, and we need those if we want to deal with climate change. So coming back to your question, how much power will the Earth's population need by 2050, and how do we know? So we've accurately modeled global energy use over the last 60 years, and we use three key variables to do that, and that's population, which is rising, average energy use per person, and the global economic growth rate. So we need energy to drive our economy, and the more the economy grows, the more energy we require. This provides us with the basis to start forecasting into the future. And so now we come down to really some of those choices. So we could choose to carry on our sort of business as usual track as we have done for the last 60 years. And in that case, we might expect a linear increase in energy demand. But the trouble with that is that we leave 50% of the population on less than $2.50 a day. And that's a question of whether that's acceptable or not. And if it's not acceptable, then we have to go down a sort of more pro-growth strategy when we need a lot more energy in order to alleviate poverty. And obviously that will rise in increased emissions as well. So really, to power a pro-growth strategy into the future, we'll see rapid rises in CO2 emissions. And well, this will fast-track us into a sort of dangerous climate change zone, which the poor are then most vulnerable to. So really what our data suggests is that the best option really is to transition in an orderly manner from fossil fuels to renewables, and this will allow us to provide the energy that we need to drive our economy and alleviate poverty while stabilizing CO2 emissions. So the bigger question is then, can we provide for what we need? And so currently our fossil fuel resources are about 60 to 150 years worth of supply based on current demand. We can find more, but at a higher price. But in contrast, we get about 5,000 times more solar energy every year, which then we need to drive our economy. So making a transition to renewables now would provide us with energy security into the future, which is good for the economy.
Well, at the same time, though, as you've said, we have to cut emissions. And by 2050, which is only 34 years away, what sort of emission cuts were set out in Paris in that climate agreement of 2015?
So in Paris, there was 96 nations who agreed to stay below 2 degrees climate change and aimed to stay below 1.5 degrees. And that was mainly to protect vulnerable island states. So once this agreement is ratified, the international community can plan how to proceed with emissions cuts. And this may be defined through nation-led bottom-up approaches rather than top-down, you know, this is what you've got to do. But the answer to your question regarding the sorts of emissions cuts that we need. So CO2 is, of course, a greenhouse gas, and the higher the concentration, the more the world will warm over time. And there's a delay, and it's important to realize there's a delay between reaching that CO2 emissions level, which locks us into, say, a 1.5 or 2 degrees temperature increase, and actually reaching that temperature increase. But at that point, when you've decided to lock in at 1.5 or 2 degrees, you have to be in balance with what the Earth can absorb in terms of CO2, and in particular what the biosphere can absorb. And the numbers tell us that, from other research, that the world absorbs about 50% of the emissions from our global energy demand. So roughly speaking, to come back to your question, is ballpark figure is we probably need to reduce our emissions by about 80% by 2050, but it may be even earlier than that. So we may, if what the models suggest are correct, then by 2020, we might have to have about emissions reductions of 50% if we want to stay below a 1.5 degree climate change level. If we want to stay below 2, it might be about 50% by 2030. And it really depends if you want to go down this pro-growth strategy or whether you want to carry on as business as usual.
So it could be 50% in 4 years from now.
It could. If you want to include, and I think this is the perhaps a safe option to take, is you want to plan ahead for poverty alleviation, then according to our model, you would have to allow for something like 50% emissions reductions in 4 years, according to that modeling data. And of course, you can say, we're not going to do that, but then you have to also make the assumption that you will keep people in poverty.
So what kind of studies have been done to project the impact of these kind of drastic fossil fuel cuts during times of rising demands? Are nations at stake, or even the whole international security system? You mentioned security.
Yeah, I mean, energy security is critical to every nation. And we need high availability of energy and also accessible energy resources. So what that means is we need to be able to access fuels, but we also need suitable fuels to access, i.e. with the right CO2 emission standards. And really, you know, nations can't risk energy security as modern economies would struggle quickly. You know, for example, previous oil crises resulted in long queues of getting gasoline very quickly. So if we want to transition from fossil fuels, and the climate data suggests that we have to, then we will need large-scale renewables quickly, in good time, to make sure that we have that stability and security in place. And then sadly, the data shows us we don't have much time. It's a really daunting task.
Now, a couple of headlines about your study said the world could warm much faster than we thought, and other projections have managed to place the rise of 2 degrees C at the end of this century. Ben Hankamer, what have you done differently that shows it may come sooner than that?
So let me be clear about this. So what we modeled was energy use and CO2 emissions. And based on this, what we can identify dates at which we lock into a particular temperature change. So that the numbers that we quote in the paper are that by 2020, we may have burnt all the fossil fuels we can burn and stay below 1.5 degrees centigrade. And by 2030, we might have locked into the emissions that we're allowed to burn by 2 degrees climate change. But locking into climate change is not the same as actual warming. The Earth will take a while to respond. So our model, you know, tells us that by that time we will burn those fuels, but I'm not a climate scientist, so I can't tell you exactly by which point the Earth would have warmed to that level.
Right. We've been told there's about a 30-year delay, so that right now we're experiencing perhaps 1985 to 95 emissions, and we'll find out later what happens with the emissions we're burning now.
That's right. But you then obviously have a very tight time window to decide. If we think that 1.5 is dangerous or 2 is dangerous, then we have to make those decisions right now in order to deal with them in this 5 to 15-year window.
And I'd like to look more deeply into the concept of personal energy use, which you developed in the paper. Here in North America, we like to think personal energy use is going down as cars become more fuel efficient, bike use increases, things like LED light bulbs slash utility bills. Is that assumption wrong?
No, that is actually correct. I mean, over the last 20 years, on average, we have become more efficient at producing things. So that's energy use per unit of GDP. And it is about a saving of about 0.6% per year. So we actually are becoming more efficient at making things. But the trouble is this, is that as we become more efficient at making things, these things become cheaper, and so we save money. And with the money that we save, we buy more stuff. And so in the end, we still use the same amount of energy or more energy because there's the energy not only in the production but also the embodied energy in the products. And a good example is smartphones. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, perhaps people didn't have so many smartphones. Now everybody's got one because we can afford it. And there will be other things like that in the future. And so energy use per person has been rising while we become more efficient at making stuff.
All right. Now, I am assuming that a huge portion of demand for personal energy will come as billions of people in the developing world get motorbikes, electric appliances, all the things we take for granted. Was that a big factor in your calculations?
It was. I mean, the last 60 years saw a broadly linear increase in global energy demand. And we think this is because a fraction, i.e. that is about 4.7 billion of the 7.4 billion people that we have on the planet in the G20 use 82% of the global energy. It's quite a shocking number. So the G20 uses 82% of global energy. But 50% of the population, both inside and outside of the G20, live on less than $2.50 a day, and so they don't have access to much energy. So now imagine if globally we introduce poverty alleviation policies to lift those 3.7 billion people from $2.50 a day to a standard of living that we accept as normal. You might expect roughly a doubling of energy demand, and then, of course, that the population is set to increase from 7.4 to 9.7 billion people as well. And after taking these things into consideration, our model suggests that we may need up to 3 times more energy by 2050 than we do now. So people may criticize this and say it's not what we've seen so far, and that's true. We haven't. It's been a slower increase. But then we must have to answer the question of whether it's acceptable to leave 50% of the population in poverty.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Ben Hankamer from the University of Queensland in Australia. I guess you've kind of got a favorite in the race for this transition to renewable energy. You mentioned solar power. You think that is our major answer coming?
I think solar power is one of the major answers coming. We have vast solar energy resources, and people don't often realize this. So the amount of solar energy that we get every year is about 5,000 times the amount that we need to drive the global economy. So there is not a shortage of solar energy. I mean, there are other renewable technologies that we can use, but this is clearly one of them.
You also mentioned, though, that a lot of our fossil fuel use is in liquid form, especially for transportation. Why don't you tell us about the Solar Biofuels Research Center in Australia?
So you have to think about what are the potential fuel options that you have. And if you want to produce fuel at a globally significant level, what you need to do is hook into a large enough energy supply to produce it. And as I've just said, the sun is the largest energy source that we have. So what we're using is we're using algae, which are photosynthetic organisms and catch sunlight. They tap into this huge solar energy resource and produce the feedstocks for fuel production. You can make a whole range of fuels from biodiesels, crude oils. You can make hydrogen and methane and ethanol. There's a whole range of different biofuels that you can make. And so our focus is on developing systems which are more efficient at producing such fuels.
Are you already producing fuel?
We are. Our aim really is not to scale commercially. Our aim is to de-risk scale up. So we do work at the lab and the pilot scale. And the reason is that as you scale up, it becomes more expensive to do those trials. And so you really need to show that you've got good techno-economic and life cycle analyses done to help industry scale and choose the right options.
Now, talking about solars, I do have listeners who post comments saying renewable energy can never solve the future demand for energy. They point out technologies like wind and solar come from cheap fossil power right now and need to be rebuilt every 30 years or so, and not to mention the carbon costs of their manufacture and all the minerals we'll need. Do we have a real solution for this conundrum?
Yeah, I don't really think this is a conundrum. All energy systems have a fixed life and will need replacing. So as we gradually scale up renewable energy systems, we provide an increasingly secure long-term energy supply. And this will then be available to power our economy, wealth generation, and infrastructure replacement. And furthermore, the embodied energy is less if we use renewable resources. So I would say to your listeners, yes, we can supply energy with renewable resources. In fact, our resources of solar energy far exceed what we have in terms of fossil fuels. So the fossil fuel deposits that we have recorded are roughly in the 60 to 150 times our global energy demand, and that's sort of in total. We can find more, but then it becomes more expensive to get them. And in contrast, every year we get 5,000 times the global energy demand from solar energy.
Well, I guess in the end, most of us want to know, and I guess it may be hard for you to answer this, but Ben Hankamer, how hot do you think the world will become and how fast?
So I'm not a climate scientist, and so I feel that I don't really think I should answer that question. What we have done is we've modeled CO2 emissions, and as I say, depending on the strategy that we move forward with in terms of poverty alleviation or not, we will have different rates of global warming. But it's really up to the climate modelers to tell us, based on these emissions, what level of warming we can expect by when. But it is possible that we get feedback loops and those sorts of things.
Well, I was going to ask you about a blog called The Arctic News, where a fellow named Sam Karana added up the increase in emissions and he tossed in various feedbacks to predict warming at least 3.9 degrees C by 2026, just 10 years from now. What do you think about such a big jump in land temperature? Is it possible in the near term?
The answer is, again, not being a climate scientist, I'm not sure that I can answer it properly. But what I would say is, you know, as I said, the modeling that we've done is on CO2. Then, of course, there's other greenhouse gas emissions that will contribute to a temperature rise. We've just had reports again today that there has been very substantial Arctic glacial ice melting that results in greater warming of the oceans, because the oceans are darker and less reflection from the ice. We've heard about melting of permafrost and the release of methane. Methane has a greenhouse gas emissions equivalent of 20 times CO2. So you end up in these sort of potential for positive feedback loops. And that's why climate modeling is so important. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, how quickly, But as we develop those models, we'll have a better idea moving forward. I don't know the answer to this 3.9 degrees C, but I think it's worth considering this as a possibility.
You know, reading your paper, I could see several narrow passages that we have to get through to survive as a civilization. I mean, we have to cut carbon. At the same time, energy demand is growing, and we also want to get people out of poverty. Do we have any idea when these key tests will develop, or is that up? So many variables we can't tell?
Well, so we have a critical bottleneck right now. As I said, you know, our modeling suggests that we will have locked into 1.5 as close to 2020 maybe, and possibly 2 degrees by 2030 if we have this poverty alleviation track. It'll be a bit longer if we don't. But once that carbon budget's been expended, we have to basically bring our emissions in balance with what the Earth can absorb, which is 50%. So basically, in terms of the bottleneck, we have about, according to our calculations, somewhere in the order of 5 to 15, 20 years to reduce our emissions by 50%. So this is a huge problem, and I don't know if you can quite imagine how we're going to change over energy systems to that degree in that period of time. And I think really what's critical right now is international leadership on this. Bringing our emissions under control to deal with climate change is like turning around a tanker. It will take time, and whether we have enough time remains to be seen. And the other thing is, I think it depends on perspective. You know, like if you live in the Philippines and you're faced with the massive storms they've had this year, or you're on an island nation and you're risking your survival based on sea levels, then these things are more urgent than perhaps a Western society where we can afford to, you know, put a new air conditioner in or something like this. So the Paris Agreement was a really important first step in dealing with these bottlenecks. But now we need strong international leadership on this issue. We need cool heads. And I think we need people with courage and an international scale project to meet this challenge.
Yes, I feel like people are kind of waiting to see what the other country will do, and that's not going to work. I wonder, as we wrap up here, is there a message in your work that I've missed or anything that you would like to add for our listeners?
So there is. I mean, I think there are a lot of things that you can do sort of at the individual level to the international level. I mean, first, we all have a vote. So my advice to those of you concerned about climate change is to use it wisely. The second is that we're increasingly connected economically and socially and environmentally, and each of us can take action at different levels. And many of these actions are beneficial to you. You know, installing solar panels a few years ago has resulted in us not paying electricity bills since, which has been great. And through investments like this, many people, photovoltaics have come down in price, making them accessible to people with lower income brackets. The third thing, you can check if your pension schemes invest in fossil fuels, and if you prefer not to, you can adjust your plan. So that's something else that can be done. You can support renewables in other ways if you choose to. But the other thing that is perhaps one of the really important issues is that the International Monetary Fund estimated that we provided about $500 billion in fossil fuel subsidies in 2008. So that's about 10% of the energy market, and it's a huge number. And the question is whether governments can't use a cost-neutral approach where instead of providing these subsidies to fossil fuels, they actually use it in a strategic manner to transition to renewables. And finally, I think the thing that we need to look at is that we very seriously need emissions reduction strategies in terms of regulation, so carbon tax. It's often not a popular subject. It's seen as being expensive in a tax. But failure to do that is going to be much more expensive in the long term.
Yes, we don't have much time. We've been talking about the coming crunch of energy demand during a period of emissions reduction. All that and more is found in the new paper published in the Open Access Journal. Anyone can read it, PLOS1. And it's under the title, Trading Off Global Fuel Supply, CO2 Emissions, and Sustainable Development. I'll put a link to that and other articles in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Our guest has been Professor Ben Hankamer from the Institute for Molecular Bioscience at the University of Queensland, Australia. Thank you so much for your help, Ben.
Thank you for your time, Alex.
Those are the choices. Let half the world's people live in poverty a while longer and keep up our energy-intensive lifestyles for maybe an extra 10 years. Then we all struggle to survive with rising seas, heat waves, drought, fires, and weather so unstable crops and species are doubtful. Or the world's leaders and peoples somehow wake up from the fog. We begin the war on carbon emissions right now to make the transition to a low-energy all-renewable world. To make the transition to a low-energy all-renewable world, it won't be the same life. It won't be easy. We have just 4 years to cut our emissions in half. It's beyond the days of worry now. It's do or die. I'm Alex Smith, and thank you for listening. Here's a quick clip from an interview with Stefan Ramsdorf. He's the German super scientist from the Potsdam Institute, currently a visiting scholar in Australia. Phil Stubbs of the Australian program TheEnvironmentShow.com caught up with him there.
So, Stefan, is the long, hot summer that we've been experiencing connected to climate change?
Yes, it is. It's part of a general warming trend, which has increased the number of heat records around the world quite dramatically. We have looked at this at our institute, and we now get five times more monthly heat records around the world than you would in an unchanging climate. And, of course, in Sydney, we have just experienced a record-breaking long spell of temperatures above 26 degrees that's been going on for more than 5 weeks now and has doubled the previous record long spell of such warm temperatures. And nationwide in Australia, a new record for March temperatures was set that was a full degree centigrade warmer than the previous record. Those are quite stunning numbers.
It's not just here in Australia, is it? Because globally, we've had record-breaking years for temperature globally. And in fact, I've heard it said that global warming's going into overdrive. Is it, in fact, speeding up?
Well, we had 2014 set a new global heat records. We had 2015, another new global hottest year on record. And now we have the beginning of 2016 coming out with these really stunning numbers. The February this year was a full 1.35 degrees warmer than the climatological baseline period in the middle of the 20th century. And up until last September, we had never had an anomaly of more than 1 degree, and now we are suddenly at 1.35 degree. That's the biggest jump upward that we have seen.
Stefan, your own country of Germany has made significant shifts away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. Can you give the listener a sense of what's happening in Germany?
Yeah, I think the German government has for many years been very aware that we are facing a climate crisis. You could actually call it a climate emergency. And the way to stop global warming is to get out of fossil fuels. And I think Germany has made some pretty good progress together with other countries like Denmark. Just to give you a number, the gross electricity production in Germany last year came 30% from renewable sources. And that's up from nearly nothing about 15 years ago. And if you look at Europe as a whole, the investments into new electricity generating capacity in Europe last year went to 77% into renewables. So the age of fossil fuels is clearly coming to an end, and investors are moving away from that and investing in renewable energy because they know that is where the future lies.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Students at the University of Minnesota recently launched a divestment campaign, urging the administration to pull its investments in companies that profit from Israel's violations of Palestinian rights. In the past few weeks, Students for Justice in Palestine and faculty at the University of Minnesota and the divestment campaign itself have been attacked, including the defacement of campaign materials with swastikas and claims of hatred against Jewish people. On March 8th, Students for Justice in Palestine said that, quote, the University of Minnesota student government body was supposed to be presented with a resolution asking our university to divest from companies that are complicit in the human rights violations of Palestinians. Instead, with a vote of 34 to 31 with 11 abstentions, they voted to strike our resolution from the agenda. Removing it from the forum agenda means it was neglected before a discussion even took place. The statement adds that more than 80 state legislators recently urged the university's president to, quote, publicly and resolutely oppose this resolution before this perilous vote is taken, in what students say was, quote, an unprecedented reach into student affairs and discussion. Joining us to talk about the current situation at the University of Minnesota is Rula Rashid, president of the SJP chapter there. Rula, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So can you talk a little bit about the divestment campaign there and how you've been organizing up to this point?
Yeah, we launched on February 15th, and we chose four companies that are complicit in the violation of international law. So we chose G4S, Ilbet Systems, Raytheon, and Caterpillar. And we, throughout our campaign, we decided to have a six-week-long campaign. Each week was focusing on one company. We wanted to be very transparent and provide all the necessary information for students. And we had events weekly. But unfortunately, our campaign was cut short. From 6 weeks, it went down to about 3 weeks or 2 weeks because there was another resolution presented by Students Supporting Israel that condemned anti-Semitism. And it was a reactionary resolution to ours, of course. So it became like Israel versus Palestine, which was never what we were trying to intend. We just wanted to focus on divesting from companies that are not socially responsible. And it ended up becoming a two-sided resolution.
Rula, can you talk a little bit more about the backlash that SJP and also members of faculty have been facing if they are seem to be sympathetic to the divestment campaign? And also about this, you know, this tactic that's being used over and over again across the country to conflate criticism of Israeli policies with anti-Semitism and how that's working on your campus.
Yeah, well, most of the backlash was revolved around that exact issue, that in their resolution, they stated that the three Ds, which is the state definition of anti-Semitism. So if you criticize Israel, you are anti-Semitic. And that's what they were portraying in their resolution and throughout their campaign. So during our campaign, we received a lot of backlash because people were claiming we were being anti-Semitic. And this encouraged outside media and outside sources to also go on and jump on this backlash. And so it ended up being that even our divestment logo was edited and it had a swastika on it and it said Jew haters and like different images that were just really disturbing for like students on campus. And it started becoming individual attacks as well. Many of our board members were attacked on Facebook with their names and like things that they've liked. And it says SJP uncovered that they like this person in the media and like, look what this person has said before, just random connections that they have made. So they essentially were creating this image that we were attacking them, their community and Israel. And so it's really, really problematic to say that the criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. But they made it seem like that on our campus, and many students started believing it and felt like it was unfair to vote for either resolution. They did see that it was unfair to vote for the anti-Semitism resolution because it silenced voices, but they also felt like it's unfair to vote for the divestment resolution. So they decided to take both down. But I think the most important thing to focus on is the fact that the backlash that the student government felt was necessary to actually take into consideration was complete false accusations, and that should have never been projected like it was.
Rula, can you talk a little bit about broader pressure by state legislators? Over 80 lawmakers mm-hmm. from the state of Minnesota also joined in the chorus against the BDS campaign at the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. In your statement, SJP says that, quote, it was not the state legislature's place to stifle student conversations on campus. Our student government should not be and cannot be a reflection of the state government. Can you talk a little bit about your reaction to, you know, dozens of state lawmakers trying to influence and pressure the goings on campus there?
Yeah, actually, the state legislators contacted the president, Kaler, on February 26th, well before our resolution was presented, and not one person knew about this, not even the president of student government. So the fact that not only that happened, but also about 20 Israeli professors gathered together to write a statement in condemning our resolution and saying that this is that they have had long standing relationships with the university and that this is an attack on the Jewish community and Israeli and Israel in general. So the attacks that the outside community, well, they pressured the president to make a statement on student government. Not only were we offended that the morning of forum, the president published this statement, but even people in student government, I mean, the president has never stepped foot into student government. Never does he put his insight on mental health awareness or sexual assault prevention or anything like that. And for him to finally, for once, say something, it is to condemn a minority's resolutions calling for their narrative of their people and to tell the students essentially not to vote for it because they oppose it. That is not okay. There have been a lot of, obviously this is not the first divestment resolution, and not once have I ever seen a president of the university respond to student government. Student government is a place for students' voices. Obviously, if the president of the university is going to respond to this, he is going to affect students' voices, especially people who are on the fence and don't know anything. They will believe what he says. They were all false accusations saying that this will divide campus and create an unsafe space for students, which is like not true at all. So it's not fair for where else would students go if they can't go to student government? I mean, that is the point that we're trying to stress, is that people keep asking us, like, why did you try going anywhere else to say this? This is where we are represented. If we can't even speak in student government and make sure that administration is not going to put their insight in here and put their what they believe, then where are we supposed to go? It was just really, really, really disappointing for many students, and not just us, but any students in the future who want to speak out about their narrative or ask something of the student body. This is a Minnesota Student Association is not the place they will go.
Rula, are SJP members and also members of the 35 different student groups who support the divestment campaign, are they going to be responding to the university president and the state legislators' pressure here?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we are right now working on, I mean, this what had happened yesterday really created a stronger solidarity on our campus. And I'm not sure if they knew this, but it fired us up even more. This is something that makes people want to speak out against it. And if they think that it's over because they shut it down once and for them, they're in for a surprise, because there are so many more student groups that have already reached out to us since yesterday. And student groups that said that they want to be neutral have jumped on board. So, this is something that many, many student groups will be responding to.
Anything else you want to say about the campaign for divestment? Where does it go from here? And what are you looking forward to in the future?
Yeah, we are not planning on waiting. We want to use the momentum that's happening right now. And we want to use the passion that everybody is feeling right now after the betrayal of our own student government. So it will be coming soon. The next forum is in April, and we will not back down no matter, you know, what the president or the authorities say. So we are really, I'm looking forward to presenting this as a way to say, you know, administration cannot speak for us on behalf of student government, and everybody should have a voice here. So this will be coming back soon.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there, but we're going to continue to watch the situation at the University of Minnesota. That's the voice of Rula Rashid. She's the president of the Students for Justice in Palestine chapter there at the University of Minnesota. Rula, if people want to learn more about UMN's divestment campaign, where can they go?
SJPUMN.com/divest.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire is produced on Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe Traditional Territory in Kingston by CFRC. I am your host, Nathan Bateman. On this episode, we'll be discussing the Women's Summit in Montreal and various other issues that pertain to International Women's Day.
Went over there, volunteered, and realized how amazing and empowering the camp can be to youth and young girls and young women, and started it over here.
My both parents were murdered while I was in residential school. My two grandfathers were murdered, still no justice. And I have a niece, Tanya Nipinak, still missing.
This proceedings, because this is new for me, that they handpicked the six of us. They purposely stacked who they wanted in court.
But first, here are the headlines. On February 22nd, hundreds of students at McGill University voted in a general assembly to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. The students called on their society to join the global movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. The motion also directed the Board of Governors, the highest governing body of McGill, to divest from three companies that are directly profiting from illegal occupation of Palestinian territory. The student vote at McGill took place on the same day the Canadian government passed a motion condemning the Boycotts, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement against Israel. The successful student vote at McGill was later defeated in a 72-hour online ratification process that may be subject to appeal due to infractions. In the hours following the release of the online ratification results, McGill's principal issued a statement. The email signed by Principal Susan Fortier explained why the university's administration continues to steadfastly oppose the BDS movement. Students, alumni, and faculty supporting BDS at McGill organized statements condemning the principal's message. Lucas, a student member of BDS McGill, spoke with CKUT about the principal's email.
Like you mentioned, we were extremely disappointed by that email. I think it was a very rash undertaking. It was sent out 30 minutes after the results of the vote, and really it condemned to more than 2,000 students that had really listened into the debate and voted in favor of BDS. The tone of the letter was disrespectful. It was condescending and very silencing, which is quite ironic because Suzanne Fortier in that email talks about equity and exchange of views, but by her silencing of our entire group, she's really breaking the discussion, and she's not clearly not ready to be open to a discussion on this. A lot of students and Palestinian students are already alienated on campus, and McGill has just grounded its implicit stance on this contentious issue by sending out such a letter.
Students from Palestine issued their own letters of support for the motion passed by McGill University students. They wrote,
"Supporting the Palestinian-led global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is one of the most important steps that student unions internationally can take to stand in solidarity with our struggle for freedom, justice, and equality."
The letter can be found online at www.pacbi.org, the website of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. That's www.pacbi.org. For more information about the campaign for BDS at McGill University, visit www.mcgillbds.com. This headline was produced by CKUT Radio in Montreal, with audio clips provided by Susan. This is a piece by myself in regards to the recent layoffs for Ontario nurses. Earlier this month, CBC reported NDP leader Andrea Horwath blamed funding shortages in healthcare as forcing nurses to do work beyond the scope of their training. Cuts in the healthcare system continue across Ontario. Just last month, over 400 registered nurses have been let go across the province. That is more than half of all the registered nurses laid off in 2015. There has been public backlash, particularly from nursing unions. Some groups have suggested overworking undertrained staff and firing hundreds of workers is an unacceptable way to pay back provincial debt, and it's time for Ontario hospitals to respect their workers as they should. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. are now listening to Groundwire. It's time for our feature story.
Next up is Audrey Obreham from Groundwire, who interviewed Marie-Josée Parent about the 2016 Women's Summit in Montreal. Parent is the manager of Destination, as well as one of the signatories of the Women's Summit Manifesto.
Marie-Josée Parent, je suis directrice
manager of Destination and Indigenous Cultural Embassy Project in Montreal. I am also co-organizer of the Women's Summit that occurred March 3rd and 4th, 2016 in Montreal, as well as co-writer of the Women's Manifest, launched in November 2015.
Je suis Mi'kmaq, Acadienne, et
I am a Mi'kmaq and Acadian and a feminist. I have decided to get involved in the Women's Summit and the writing of the Manifest, as I think it is an aberration to still have to fight for gender equality in today's world. It is a citizen summit that seeks to provide a space for discussion to all citizens. The goal is to include Indigenous women, to give ourselves a space in the society at large, to create a space where role models can have a voice so that our young people get involved and are able to understand that they can also build the world to their image and liking. Our Indigenous women are involved in discussion panels such as young women and activism, violence towards women. They are our conference speakers, our organizers. They are experts in the same way as all of the other women. We sought them out because of their expertise, their understanding of the world, their worldview, rather than solely because they are Indigenous.
You are listening to Groundwire. Michael Welch from CKUW brings us coverage from the February 14, 2016 search for missing and murdered Indigenous women in Winnipeg. He also updates us on the 3-day consultation with the families of missing and murdered Indigenous women that occurred in Winnipeg on February 24th to 26th, 2016.
February 14th marked the 9th annual Women's Memorial March in Winnipeg. Over 100 people made it out to the Winnipeg event. Some of those voices let us know what the gathering meant to them.
Something needs to be done, and it needs to be in a respectful way.
My friend Jennifer Catchaway has been missing since June 2008. That's why I come out all the time.
We're all doing this together as cousins in our community. So we're here to support women and children. We're here to support all vulnerable people.
My both parents were murdered while I was in residential school. My two grandfathers were murdered, still no justice. And I have a niece, Tanya Nipinak, still missing. Every event that's happening, I join.
Nahani Fontaine, Special Advisor on Aboriginal Women's Issues for the Government of Manitoba. Probably in 1999, there was a mom who was shot and killed. And her little son was shot as well. And I remember at that time, the individual that did it was completely exonerated. For me, that completely enraged me. For that to happen in Canada, it just was something that I felt I had to stand against. And so literally, I remember that was one of those first moments that that was the beginning for me on this journey.
The federal Liberals have promised an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and have consulted families of the missing and murdered. Bernadette Smith is the sister of Claudette Osborne, who went missing in 2008. She attended these consultations, including the National Roundtable, which took place in Winnipeg, February 24th, 26th.
You know, our ministers and our premiers went back to their provinces with, you know, hopefully some tangible things that they can do. And we really gave credit, a lot of credit, to Premier Wynne in Ontario for announcing $100 million to, you know, address the violence against women. So we're really looking for those kinds of things to be happening in other provinces as well. And, you know, they have a plan that they're rolling out with some tangible things that are going to address that. So, you know, enough of the talk. Now it's time for the action.
In recent days, a 14-year-old teenager named Brianna Johnny made headlines after writing an open letter to the chief of the Winnipeg Police Service arguing that authorities treat missing person cases differently when the person reported is Indigenous. She mentioned that public searches for non-Indigenous Winnipeggers like Cooper Nemeth began within a day of him going missing, while the search for 15-year-old Tina Fontaine was not publicized until 4 days after her disappearance.
You know, I think about the response from, you know, the father of Cooper Nemeth's dad, right? And him saying that, you know, it takes family and community and assembling those people, right? When my sister went missing, like, our family assembled and we did what we could. But ultimately, you know, we felt that our race had a lot to do with it, because some people didn't come out because, you know, we're Indigenous and, you know, just another, you know, girl gone missing, you know, desensitized, not my problem, it's over there. And I think, you know, some people are privileged in the very color of their skin, and they've never had to feel that. So, you know, I think of those stories, and how do we help people understand the privilege that they're coming from, and how to deconstruct that and make it into a constructive kind of, you know, part of Canada and helping one another.
From Winnipeg on Treaty One territory, on the homeland of the Métis Nation, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Up next, we hear from Yvonne Tupper, member of Treaty 8, with her response to Supreme Court injunction order on Protectors of the Land versus BC Hydro CITEC Dam in British Columbia.
And with the terms of we have less than 12 hours to vacate, I'm in Vancouver right now. It's a 14-hour drive for me to drive back to the camp, and so I got to make this press conference short because I need to be with my campers back up north. Are there any questions? I plan to respect the injunction, yes. Well, I kind of knew that when I learned that BC had, during this proceedings, because this is new for me, that they handpicked the six of us. They purposely stacked who they wanted in court, not the other 25-plus people that were in camp in January 2016 or the others that came afterwards in February. And also to the other respective members that are concerned about our valley that was there. So they hand-selected who they wanted in the courtroom and be named.
And why do you think they did that and chose the people they did?
As you heard this today in court, that with the other four court cases, they were successful, and two of them to defeat them in court. So two are on appeal, and we're still waiting for justice review for treaty rights and other matters. And also, too, there's upcoming court cases that was applied opposing Site C.
What sort of emotion are you feeling?
Well, you know, I kind of expected this as, sorry, you weren't here earlier when I said our treaty rights is a promise with the federal government. It's upheld and honored by the federal government, not with the BC Supreme Court, obviously, and not with the provincial court. This, what it does inspire me to say is that BC Hydro and the BC government need to start looking at culture competencies and start learning about Indigenous peoples and treaty rights. We're a named number treaty in the northeast of BC, which is unique than other Aboriginal titles of BC. We have a large area mass of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Northwest Territories. And to learn about us through this process, we have 40 years of saying no from other political First Nations throughout the years. This is nothing new for us, but here to have a Supreme Court ruling, we're not here to not obey it. We're here to obey it. But we also, I knew that this is not the forum for it.
Well, the judge talked a lot about what's in the public interest. Talk about what you felt when you heard him say that.
Well, I'm quite the complex human being. I felt a lot of range of emotions, but also, too, is like, to know that the defense, our affidavits for defense, our expert witnesses, actually proved that if the cost delay for the Site C dam for 2 years is $518 million, you know, we'd be saving BCians as a whole money if this dam is not constructed. And the recent dates of Jessica McDonough announcing the 4% increase rate And one of them probably would be Bede, because LNG and other components to the Site C dam backed away. And so this dam is not needed. It's not so green dam with lifelong massive destruction. And to me, that, you know, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't done properly, put it that way. If the consultation that they spoke about was done properly with listening and hearing and changing, instead of saying, oh, look, we're here and we're going to do it. Now you're chose. You have to say yes.
Brent Keith Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of BC Union Chiefs. I just want to begin by saying the UBCIC still stands in solidarity with Treaty 8 stewards of the land. And I want to make it very clear here today that this fight is by no means over. This was a minor skirmish in the BC Supreme Court. It certainly is not the final chapter in this sordid narrative of the Site C Dam that seems like it'll never die, this zombie tale of the Site C Dam. The judge himself admitted that this is an enormous issue and that there are a multitude of very, very serious and important issues in play here, and the courtroom is not the venue to sort out those issues. So again, this is just another day at the office, another battle in this decades-old fight. The provincial government, through BC Hydro, keeps changing their story about why this dam is necessary. It was bitterly disappointing to hear a status quo judgment in a world that has changed dramatically with respect to Indigenous land rights. Obviously, the courts have not caught up. And, you know, tomorrow's another day to continue this fight. I'm incredibly proud and honored to stand in solidarity with Treaty 8 stewards of the land, many of them which are young women who are standing on their treaty rights. And at the end of the day, the treaty rights will prevail.
This audio was brought to us by Gennarji O'Sullivan from CFRO. CJSF brings us an interview about Girls Rock Camp.
Next up, we have an interview with Louie from Girl Rock Camp. Girls Rock Camp is a summer camp for girls focused on learning instruments and the joy of playing music. Campers participate in instrument instructions, workshops, and band practice where they collaborate with their band and write an original song. No musical experience is necessary. Girls Rock Camp is inspired by the needs to promote change in the music industry and young women's lives.
So we have Louie on the phone.
Hi.
Hi, Louie. This is Natalie. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'd like to ask you first, where did the idea for this camp originate from?
Well, it's a whole string of camps happening internationally. And so Vancouver's Girls Rock Camp, I do not believe, was the originator of the camp.
Okay.
Definitely a group of people about 7 years ago heard about camp and recognized the power it had, and I believe that some of those organizers had attended and volunteered at the Portland Girls Rock Camp. So they went over there, volunteered, and realized how amazing and empowering the camp can be to youth and young girls and young women, and started it over here.
Well, that's great. And how do you feel that this camp has evolved over the years?
I think it just keeps growing. More and more people want to participate. Lots of volunteers want to be part of it. And there's so many campers that want to be going to this camp every year. And unfortunately, there's a huge wait list for it. So not as many youth and girls get to participate in the camp as we wish we could, but we're trying to work on that and get more funding so we can put more than one camp on every year.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. And where is the camp run currently, or this summer, where will it be running?
Yeah, it's happening and it's hosted at UNYA, the Urban Native Youth Association, and they have been very generous with their space, and they give us their space free of charge every summer for 1 week.
Oh, that's wonderful. So it's only 1 week.
Yeah, it's 1 week of camp.
Also, you can understand why there would be a wait list for it.
Exactly.
And so how many volunteers are working on this project?
During camp, there's probably about 30 to 40 volunteers, and then there's 30 campers. So there's almost more volunteer adults to the camp than there are campers themselves.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
So what kind of instruments are taught?
There is keyboards, so electric keyboards, drums, guitar, bass, and vocals. Those are kind of our main spots.
And has registration already started for the summer?
We have just received the camp dates. Camp will be from July 25th to July 29th. And we are sending out registration very soon. So probably this coming week.
And how?
Possibly in the next 2 weeks, yeah.
Okay, great. And do you have a link for us, a website where people can go to if they're interested? Because it sounds like such a great initiative. I know that actually one of Ayana's friends was in camp last year.
Oh, no way. That's so great. Yeah. So good to hear.
Yeah, it was really
If you go to girlsrockcampvancouver.ca, that is our website, and you can find all the information on there how to register.
You are listening to Groundwire. Now it's time for our community radio report. For this edition, we bring you coverage of International Women's Day by AMARC.
We start by speaking to Andrea O'Reilly, a professor of gender, sexuality and women's studies at York University in Toronto. Andrea is a prolific writer and researcher on the topic of motherhood and the social construct of what she calls intensive mothering.
How has motherhood changed in the last 20 years? Good question and a hard question. I teach a course at York University, a full-year women's studies course. When I open my course, I often ask my students, what is a good mother today? What is she supposed to look like? What is she supposed to do? What traits is she supposed to have? And I'm quite amazed how much these students are in agreement. And many of them are not mothers. They're young, you know, women, not yet considering motherhood. But they agree. They, even though they're not mothers, they've been already very much affected by the dominant, what I call the dominant discourse or the dominant ideology. And they all say, well, a mother should be, you know, a certain age, right? You can't be too young anymore. So you have to be, in your late 20s to your early 30s. If you're 18, you're too young. If you're 40, you're too old. A mother is supposed to be patient. She's never to anger. Her whole life is to center on her children. They must come first. Mother love is considered timeless, the best. Any care given other than the biological mother is seen as insufficient. And that includes even husbands, that children should be raised by the biological mother 24/7, around the clock. She should be completely attuned to the needs of the child. More recently, which I can talk more about later, in the last 10 or 15 years, the ante's been up that she's supposed to be completely devoted and her life is to center upon the cognitive, behavioral, educational, psychological development of her child. It's just not enough to feed and clothe and hug your baby anymore. You have to raise the super child who will get into Harvard by 12 and, you know, discover the cure by cancer by 13 and read 3 languages by 5.
Well, it was really interesting, the interview with Andrea, because it was totally spontaneous. I saw her in the corridor at the University of Ottawa. I was there for a conference, and so was she. And she was actually selling books. And I had no intention of interviewing her, but she just seemed such a dynamic, lively person selling these books that I asked her whether I could interview her, and she said yes. So I think that motherhood is a really great example or expression of how we are controlled in Western society by capitalism, by globalization, by making us constantly feel insecure. We're never good enough. And the prime case where we're never good enough is as mothers. We never quite make the grade. And that was what I wanted to talk to her about.
When I talk about this to my students, they think this type of motherhood has been around forever. Children need this. They believe fundamentally this excessive child-centered, consumer, materialist-based mothering is necessary for children's well-being. And that's the first struggle because in my work I argue fundamentally this is not good for kids or for mothers. And I really try to get my students to think about motherhood outside of a biological natural paradigm. And I say to them, there's nothing natural about motherhood. And they have great resistance to that. The point I simply try to make is the meaning of motherhood, how we are expected to mother, told to mother, is culturally determined. It changes radically throughout history, and the work I do is to try to put motherhood in historical context and to show my students, and in my own writing, how motherhood is constantly reinvented. So what was a good mother in 1950s, today, she would certainly not qualify as a good mother. She'd be considered a bad mother. And yet, in her time, a 1950s mother would be considered a good mother. But the standards of motherhood have changed fundamentally and radically in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
What was the economic event that changed it? You know, you were talking about the post-war right. years and the 50s and the 60s where it was absolutely much more laid back to the point where I... too ashamed to discuss my daughter's childhood with her. But then it changed again.
My argument and what I do in my research is I think it changed, began to change in the mid-1980s. We certainly saw the beginning of it earlier, but I really believe the 1970s was probably the best time to be a mother, because not only did you have relaxed motherhood, but now you had feminism too. Right. So what happens in the 80s that causes motherhood and eventually gives rise to what us scholars call intensive mothering, this highly competitive, completely regulatory mothering where if you're not a good mom, you're nothing, right? The standards have gone through the roof. Your child, as I said, has to speak 3 languages by 5, has to read by 1. Hyper, hyper competitive. More generally, the rise of consumerism and materialism more generally in the 80s, where class becomes marked through personal acquisition of wealth, right? Bigger homes, bigger cars, bigger vacations. And children become a status symbol. They become the new accessory that marks your class. And in the 50s, you marked your class by having a stay-at-home wife. You knew you made it to the middle class when you had a stay-at-home wife. Well, that's not possible in the 80s anymore. With the 2 recessions we had, middle-class families have working wives. So you can't mark your class anymore by having your wife at home. So you marked your class through children. So the smarter child, the child with the best clothes, the best bedroom, the most stuff, becomes a marker of class mobility. And so that's one thing. I really think it's tied in with class. I think another big reason is simply demographics. Women started having fewer children in the 70s and 80s.
We're speaking to Andrea O'Reilly, a professor of gender, sexuality and women's studies at York University in Toronto.
That's it for this edition of Ground Wire, produced by CFRC. Music this week was by Feist. Headlines this week were written by Gretchen King. And we also thank Gennarji O'Sullivan, Michael Welch, and Audrey O'Brien. Tune in again to hear Ground Wire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Ground Wire is a project of the members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Mondo mourned. He was born David Rice, and in his youth he joined an offshoot of the Black Panther Party, a decision that would change his life's trajectory. For when he and another young man, Edward Poindexter, joined the National Committee to Combat Fascism, they walked into the crosshairs of the state. The two men became enmeshed in a COINTELPRO scheme to remove them from the streets of Lincoln, Nebraska. Rice and Ed were charged with the August 1970 killing of an Omaha cop who picked up a briefcase loaded with dynamite. According to the group Nebraskans for Justice, another man, Christopher Peek, was the state's only suspect in the bombing. But shortly thereafter, after first exonerating Rice and Poindexter, Peek would become the state's chief witness against them. In April 1971, both men were convicted and given life terms. Such flimsy evidence would be a factor in Amnesty International naming the two Panthers as prisoners of conscience. On Sunday, we learned that Rice, who had changed his name to Mondo Welanga, died a lonely death in his prison cell after many years in a cage. Mondo and Ed were members of the National Committee to Combat Fascism, but in truth, they were Panthers, for that is certainly how the state treated them. Mondo Welanga and Ed Poindexter were servants of the people, dedicated to their freedom and dignity. Mondo Welanga and Ed Poindexter were soldiers for the people, dedicated to their defense and security. Mondo Welanga is no more. Neither is David Rice. And yet Mondo will be remembered for many long years for his service. Mondo, after many, many years in a cage, now joins his ancestors. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I said that one needn't worry about billionaire presidential candidate Donald Trump, who wouldn't last. I was wrong. I seriously underestimated Trump's ability to pummel and assail his opponents. I should have known better. For money is the mother's milk of politics. And while Trump hasn't been forced to spend his resources, his opponents have been bleeding green. Trump's bombast has attracted the brutish spirits of their nature to arise from their growling slumber. Now, presidential rallies are fistfights and curses, especially when Trump protesters are black folks. The ugly image of white-haired retirees pushing and punching young people the age of their grandchildren reveals the roiling racist hatreds that lurk beneath, awaiting activation. Trump, with an easy cruelty, gives permission for these assaults by his minions. Richard Hofstadter, the brilliant author of the classic The Paranoid Style in American Politics, examined the American right wing and particularly described what he called pseudo-conservatives in their ranks. Hofstadter writes that those new dissenters, he's writing in the 1950s, are a threat to true conservatism, explaining, the new dissent is certainly not radical. They are hardly any radicals of any sort left, nor is it precisely conservative. Unlike most of the liberal dissent of the past, the new dissent not only has no respect for nonconformism, but it is based upon a relentless demand for conformity. It can most accurately be called pseudo-conservative because its exponents, although they believe themselves to be conservatives and usually employ the rhetoric of conservatism, show signs of a serious and restless dissatisfaction with American life, traditions, and institutions. They have little in common with the temperate and compromising spirit of true conservatism, in the classical sense of the word, and they are far from pleased with the dominant practical conservatism of the moment as it is represented by the Eisenhower administration. Their political reactions express rather a profound, if largely unconscious, hatred of our society and its ways, a hatred which one would hesitate to impute to them if one did not have suggestive evidence both from clinical techniques and from their own modes of expression. Richard Hofstadter's insights from a half century ago show the moment we now inhabit. Raw, naked hatreds exploited for political purposes to fuel social discontent, to buttress political ambitions of the neo-fascists, forces unleashed to sow the seeds of disaster. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Solidarity. The word has been spoken for the better part of a century at least. Like many words of such ancient vintage, what it means today may vary from what it meant at the dawn of the 20th century. For we mustn't forget the 20th century was among the bloodiest of the history of man, not to mention women. World War I and II were modern-day charnel houses. The flowing blood of millions, genocide for the racist excesses of capitalism and imperialism. What does solidarity mean today? We know what it doesn't mean. Press releases, leaflets, a formulaic statement from various leaders. It means sharing struggle and sacrifice, often on the ground, together. Solidarity means shared struggle and sacrifice, now across the illusory walls of ivory towers and the ivied silos of separation. It means shared threats and danger. It means that or nothing. It also means that no one movement can cure the ills that faces us. That means we must learn to accept other struggles, to embrace them, to build real, functional unity against a system that is literally killing us. If we can't build a sufficient movement, how can we build and transform a nation? This is not a rhetorical question. It's a real one that must be resolved and answered honestly. For complete social transformation must be our goal, or else the system will don a new mask and torment the lives and dreams of millions anew. Solidarity must be more than a word, a press release, a tweet, or a promise. It must become our activity, what we do as opposed to what we say, our reality. For only then can a new future come into being. I wrote these words last night, but upon reflection, I want to add something, just extemporaneously. As I wrote these words, I was thinking about a person that is familiar to all of you, at least his name is. I was thinking about Fred Hampton, the former Deputy Minister of Defense of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. A young guy, 20, 21. This is the man that the Chicago Police Department and the FBI killed in his bed. Why did they do that? Not just because he was a Black Panther, or they would have done it to all of us. Their intelligence taught them and showed them that this young man was a powerful organizer. He was the man who really built the original Rainbow Coalition. And he understood that by working with poor white working class people in Illinois. Poor Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, Asian Americans. He understood that to make a revolution takes all of us. And they understood it. His enemies understood it. That's why they killed him in his sleep. Learn the lesson of Fred Hampton, to work together to build a true revolutionary movement to transform this hell that is our present. I thank you for your time. On the move, long live John Africa. Let us end the mass incarceral state. Free the Move 9 from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The presence of U.S. presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump signal that Wall Street and other elites are losing their grip on the American political landscape? Does Sanders represent a fundamental departure from America's imperialist foreign policy? In what ways is the system being rigged to secure Hillary Clinton as the next U.S. president? What mechanisms are in place to ensure the next president will comply with the demands of the powers that be? Is there any chance that the will of the American people can prevail over the special big-moneyed interests that dominate the White House and Capitol Hill? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at the U.S. presidential campaign, but with a focus on how the body politic is being manipulated and who benefits. We speak with journalist, historian, and author William Bloom, and with writer, political activist, and ecological campaigner Mark Robinowitz. On this week's program, U.S. Campaign 2016, Searching for Democracy in a Broken System. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 18th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. So, with the ceasefire agreement barely holding on, the peace talks taking place at the United Nations and the threat of a Turkish GCC invasion of Syria looming in the background, the question now is whether or not the situation will gradually trend toward peace and de-escalation, or whether it will in fact escalate to a wider war between the opposing forces in Syria, as well as other interested international actors. After all, Staffan de Mistura, the UN special envoy for the Syria crisis, has already described the talks as essentially the only thing holding back an even wider full-scale war in Syria. While he made no effort to clarify what he meant by comment, the world outside of the Western countries are generally aware of the American agenda in Syria. Informed observers generally recognize that the NATO bloc, along with Israel and the GCC, are not content to simply admit they have been routed, pick up their ball, and go home. They continue to adapt to their own methods in much the same way as the Russians, and will respond as soon as they have surveyed the chessboard and have selected their next move. That comes from the article, What the Russian Withdrawal from Syria Means and What It Doesn't, by Brandon Turbeville, posted March 16th, originally appearing at brandonturbeville.com. The Israeli government is having to plan how to deal with a Trump presidency and the loss of $6 billion a year in U.S. military equipment, arms, loans, grants, and gifts from an AIPAC-led Congress. Just as Benjamin Netanyahu is wondering how to replace the EU, his primary trading market, in the event that Europe decides to implement sanctions against his continued illegal occupation of Palestinian land, he now faces the possibility of having to deal with a Republican president who will certainly not be a patsy in a lobby-controlled White House. The current global attitude to Israel's continued illegal settlement policy has now hardened into one of angry impatience at Netanyahu's obstructive tactics in regard to the establishment of an independent state of Palestine to accommodate a dispossessed indigenous people of over 5 million. Also, as a consequence of Israel's 6-year blockade of essential medical, food, and building supplies into Gaza in close cooperation with the Egyptian dictator Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, 1.8 million civilians are still living in a bombed-out enclave reduced to rubble, and with only enough food to keep the entire population at just above subsistence level, atrocities perpetrated by the Israeli government. However, there now appears to be the possibility of a consensus for a UN resolution to force Israel to comply with international law and for the imposition of a deadline for compliance, failing which U.S. and EU bilateral trade with the Israeli state could be drastically restricted. That there seems to be a paradigm shift in the international attitude towards Israeli policy in the occupied territories is an essential factor in Middle East politics and future peace, and with a Trump presidency, that will almost certainly become a priority for the United States and for the European Union. That comes from the article, "A Donald Trump Presidency Could Mean Israel Losing $6 Billion in U.S. Aid," by Anthony Bell Chambers, posted March 16th. Washington will not lift the sanctions imposed after the reunification of Crimea with Russia until Moscow decides to return Crimea to Ukraine, the spokesman for the U.S. State Department said. Crimea, which has a predominantly ethnically Russian population, ceded from Ukraine to rejoin Russia 2 years ago, following a referendum on March 16th in which over 96% of voters supported the move. "We will not accept the redrawing of borders by force in the 21st century. Sanctions related to Crimea will remain in place as long as the occupation continues. We again call on Russia to end that occupation and return Crimea to Ukraine," John Kirby said in a statement Wednesday. Well, that comes from the article, "Washington will retain sanctions until Russia returns Crimea." John Kerry says, "We will not accept redrawing borders," by Sputnik, posted March 16th. The curious mystery surrounding the shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine on July 17th, 2014, gets more curious and more curious as the U.S. government and Dutch investigators balk at giving straightforward answers to the simplest of questions, even when asked by the families of the victims. Adding to the mystery, Dutch investigators have indicated that the Dutch Safety Board did not request radar information from the United States, even though Secretary of State John Kerry indicated just 3 days after the crash that the U.S. government possessed data that pinpointed the location of the suspected missile launch that allegedly downed the airliner, killing all 298 people on board. Although Kerry claimed that the U.S. government knew the location almost immediately, Dutch investigators now say they hope to identify the spot sometime, quote, in the second half of the year, unquote, meaning that something as basic as the missile launch site might remain unknown to the public more than 2 years after the tragedy. The families of the Dutch victims, including the father of a Dutch-American citizen, have been pressing for an explanation about the slow pace of the investigation and the apparent failure to obtain relevant data from the U.S. and other governments. I spent time with the family members in early February at the Dutch Parliament in The Hague as opposition parliamentarians, led by Christian Democrat Pieter Omtzigt, unsuccessfully sought answers from the government about the absence of radar data and other basic facts. That comes from the article, "The Ever-Curiouser MH17 Case," by Robert Perry, posted March 17th, originally appearing at Consortium News. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Politics has been called a rigged game, with elites using money and organizational resources to pull the puppet strings of most candidates for high office. However, the entrance into the race for U.S. president of candidates Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, who both reject funding from Wall Street, threatens to challenge that truism. This week's Global Research NewsHour attempts to cut through the propaganda and jargon and assess what real options are out there for making substantive and humane political change. I first connected with a longtime critic of U.S. foreign policy, who recently wrote an article suggesting Hillary Clinton might be a worse choice than Trump. Well, we're very honored to welcome to the program William Bloom. He is an author and critic of U.S. foreign policy. He abandoned his position with the U.S. State Department almost half a century ago to become a vocal critic of the U.S. foreign policy in the wake of their actions in Vietnam. He's been a freelance journalist and helped found and edit Washington's first alternative newspaper, the Washington Free Press. He's the author of five books, including the 1995 classic Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, as well as the more recent America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. William Bloom is also the author of several articles which appear on his website, williambloom.org. And he is also many of his articles appear on the Global Research website. So, William Bloom, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so interesting times. We've got this presidential election campaign, but I just wanted to maybe give, just to put it in a bit of a historical context. I know you're a long-standing critic of U.S. foreign policy, and so in that regard, I guess I'm just kind of curious to see if there are any elections in the last 50 years or so that you might be inclined to point to as interesting in terms of potential turning points.
Turning point in what?
Well, in terms of, maybe potentially being interesting in any capacity in terms of, actually having making a real difference or having where there's a lot at stake.
Well, the only candidates I would feel inclined to vote for in the past 50 years were third-party candidates. Ralph Nader a few times and the woman who's the head of the Green Party, Stein. What's her first name?
Jill
Stein. I think this coming election, I think I'll probably vote for her. But I haven't voted for a Democrat or a Republican since 1964 when I voted for Johnson, but that was mainly a vote against Goldwater. Now there's no one like Johnson. I mean, now I would vote against Clinton or Trump, but there's no one in the two major parties I could vote for.
Mm.
As I've written in my current anti-empire report, if I was forced to make a choice between Clinton and Trump, I would choose Trump. And that's because of foreign policy issues. The U.S. foreign policy is the world's greatest threat to peace and prosperity and the environment. And I cannot support them against that policy against anything else. Trump is largely unknown. What he'll do in office is anyone's guess. But he has made a number of statements on foreign policy which indicate some hope. He's made it clear that he would be willing to talk to Putin, and he doesn't regard him in the same enemy context as Clinton does, and even Sanders. Sanders, I support on domestic issues, but he on foreign policy, he's not very good. He could win the election over Clinton if he would attack her on her foreign policy policy, because she has done some terrible things, which I'm sure all the people who love her have no idea about. He could really show her for what she is if he would speak in detail about her role in Honduras and in Iraq and in Syria and especially in Libya. She caused a great horror in Libya. So I think Sanders is missing out on a good chance by not exploiting Clinton's foreign policy.
You said something quite
what I think would be astonishing to a lot of people, the idea that, like, I think a lot of people do recognize the problems with Hillary Clinton, including a large number of Bernie Sanders supporters who are pledging not to support Hillary should Bernie Sanders not make the nomination, but they still see her as the lesser of two evils. And
what are the between
Clinton and Trump?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't see it. I think she.
But you think she's the worse of the two?
I think she is a neocon, and she would bomb anyone if and laugh about it. I said she laughed about the horrible death of Gaddafi in Libya. She can be charming, but they all learn how to do that. But behind her charm is a cold-blooded killer, I think. That may sound very extreme, but if you know the details of what she has done and what she's advocated, then I think you might agree. Mm. And that's what Sanders should find out about and exploit. He doesn't do that. He doesn't...
Well, he did actually – the one thing that did come up, and I think this may be kind of connecting with what you're saying, there was a point where she was basically boasting about her connection with Henry Kissinger.
Oh, yeah.
And Bernie Sanders came right out and said that he was very critical of Henry Kissinger and takes pride in the fact that he doesn't consider Henry Kissinger a friend. So that is kind of getting –
I saw that. Yeah, right. And that's one good point. There's so much more that he could say on foreign policy. So much more.
Could you? I know you've been like a critic of foreign policy in South America and in Asia, Middle East. But I think maybe we need to really drill down on that point with regard to Bernie Sanders about his less than adequate positions on foreign policy. I mean, what the things that he's saying. That causes you so much concern that you.
Well, he refers to Hugo Chavez of Venezuela as, quote, that dead communist dictator, unquote. I mean, no one with any pretension of being a progressive should make such a remark. I mean, it's absurd. It's what we would expect from a stupid right winger, and he says things like that. I've never heard him. I haven't read anything really progressive on foreign policy. I doubt if he's ever used the word imperialism, for example. And I doubt if he has said that the U.S. is largely responsible for the horrible mess of the Middle East with all the refugees. That is a result of the U.S. government overthrowing the governments of Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria, which is not quite complete yet. Those four governments, and all of them were secular governments. It's very important to keep in mind. He overthrew the four leading, the U.S. overthrew the four leading secular governments of the Middle East and South Asia, and we shouldn't be surprised that the replacement of that was a fanatic Islamic movement. We are responsible for that, and I don't think he thinks that way at all.
And he's not been his position with regard to the kind of thawing Cold War. You don't find that he'd be an ideal person to have in that position.
Which Cold War?
Basically with U.S. and Russia currently, with it seems like tensions between the United States and Russia are on the increase, and so I was wondering about Bernie Sanders and where you would see what a president Bernie Sanders would be like in the context of U.S. Russia relations.
Yeah, I'm not certain, but I don't think that he. I haven't seen any comment on that kind from him. Uh, um, I don't expect much along those lines. They were doing mock. I just quoted about Hugo Chavez. I mean, no one who would say that is going to be very enlightened on Cold War issues. And if you think that a leading socialist activist in the world is just a dead communist dictator, I mean, it's absurd. A man who was elected legally and honestly about four or five times, it shouldn't be called a dictator. And a man who was a real socialist as opposed to Bernie Sanders, who, in my opinion, is not a socialist at all. I've written about this in one of my anti-empire reports a few months ago. I discussed the question, is Bernie Sanders a socialist? And my answer is no. So I can't expect him to have any kind of enlightened viewpoint on any Cold War issue.
Well, I know that the big plus for Bernie, for a lot of people, is his not accepting donations from the big special interests, you know, like
Wall
Street.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't get it anyhow. They know who he is, and they can recognize their enemy very well, and they wouldn't. As does the media, you know, I've been hearing reports the past few days how the networks have been ignoring Sanders. They haven't even covered his speeches very well at all. They know that he's a threat. And as opposed to Clinton, who was one of the boys. And so. If I was forced to choose between Clinton and Sanders, I certainly would choose Sanders. But that's a separate question.
Mm. And I know that a very important element of U.S. foreign policy is with regard to the Middle East and dealings with Israel. And I understand that the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, AIPAC, has been very influential on presidents and on Congress. So I'm wondering how you would, you know, given those realities, who would be best to have as president, you know, like in terms of American-Israeli policy?
Between Sanders and Trump, I would choose Trump.
Really?
Yeah. Sanders, you know, he spent time in Israel, and he's Jewish, and he and proud of it, we're dealing with some unknown areas to a large extent. I would guess that in office, Trump would be more hostile or less acquiescent to Israel than Sanders would be. Trump has said more than once that he would be even-handed when it comes to Israel, which for an American politician is saying quite a bit. I can't be sure until they were in office, but I would expect a better policy on Israel from Trump than I would from Sanders.
Yeah, I think that the way, though, with Mr. Trump, he's been saying some very remarkable things during the course of the campaign. I mean, things about the banning of Muslims and surveillance of mosques and building a wall with Mexico and just the antics that have been happening through the campaign with the protesters being beaten up. And of course, he's quite surly, as I know you've acknowledged some of those negative points. And I think that there's a sense among a lot of people that this is some kind of a wild man. And do we really want to trust this guy with his finger on the nuclear button? I mean, what would you say to those sorts?
Yeah, I agree he with all those things. As I wrote, I'd have a hard time being a friend of his, because I think he's kind of obnoxious on a personal level. But that is not what concerns me. I'm concerned about foreign policy. I'm concerned about putting an end to the empire. The empire is going crazy. It's been going crazy for decades, and it's making a mess of the world. And what we have in the Middle East now is the latest example. And I'm concerned about having someone in the White House who will not be a fully grown supporter of imperialism and Trump, I think, will not be. Clinton would be. Sanders would be closer to Clinton than to Trump. But this is, again, this is, we don't know for sure until they're in the office.
Mr. Bloom, I was wondering if, I mean, because you mentioned media earlier with regard to ignoring Sanders. I'm wondering if there are other things about what you're seeing of the media coverage that seems to be manipulating people in an undemocratic way. Are there any particular examples that come to mind?
Well, if you read some of the interviews with Trump, like Stephanopoulos, he's at NBC, right?
I believe so, yes. Yes.
He accused, he was attacking Putin, and Trump was making somewhat of a defense of Putin, and Stephanopoulos said that Putin just, he killed journalists. You know, and Trump doesn't know enough to respond to such things. I've written about that. I've given a long list of journalists killed by the U.S. in recent years. If Trump could use me as an advisor, frankly, and because to fend off all these stupid remarks made to him and against him by the American mass media, these people on the networks are really uneducated. They're uninformed. It's embarrassing. If I was a supporter of the government and the foreign policy, I'd be embarrassed at least. But Stephanopoulos and his ilk, they're really uninformed. That's why they have the jobs they do. If Stephanopoulos knew what I knew, he wouldn't be in that position. He wouldn't be hired. And that's a sad fact of our media.
Mm. Interesting. So looking forward, I mean, what are your thoughts about the way this thing is going to play out as we get closer to November? Do you have a pretty good idea of who the nominees are going to be and how
I guess. I mean, I don't have any instant information. I guess it will be Clinton and Trump. But I'm glad for the first time in many years to have an election campaign that is somewhat interesting. In the past, I wouldn't have paid any attention to all this nonsense going on. But now it's fun to watch. So I'm glad for that.
Okay. Looking at the parties themselves, the Democrats and the Republicans, it seems clear that you see those parties as pretty much beyond repair.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
At what point would you say, I mean, was it always this way, or was there a point where it was like they had their golden era and then they just kind of deteriorated into some basic, you know, acolytes for the establishment? Was this always their function?
The behavior of the individuals, especially amongst the Republicans, is really shocking. It's embarrassing. It wasn't always that way. There was in the 1950s when I was growing up. I mean, there were Republicans I could admire somewhat, like Eisenhower. But now they're all a bunch of clowns, and the Democrats are not much better. They can't even get a vote in Congress for this or that important issue. It's really embarrassing. I mean, I'm speaking as an outsider, and I'm going to vote for the Green Party, and I don't have anything to do with the other two major parties.
Well, William Bloom, it's been a great pleasure having this conversation with you and hearing your thoughts, and I want to thank you for being my guest and for
thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, can I just mention my website, please?
Yes, please.
It's williambloom.org, and Bloom is B-L-U-M.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with author and historian William Bloom. His latest book is America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else, published by Zed Books in the U.K. and Fernwood Books in Canada. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We're joined now by Mark Robinowitz. He is the publisher of oilempire.us, a political map to connect the dots. And as he describes it, he's been a writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner for over three decades. He's also author of the upcoming Peak Choice, Cooperation or Collapse, an uncensored guide to earth, energy, and money. And he also claims to have been very strongly influenced by one of JFK, the former President John Fitzgerald Kennedy's last initiatives before he was assassinated. So, Mark Robinowitz, welcome to our show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Now, I was just mentioning the fact that you, the influence of John F. Kennedy that you mentioned. You want to maybe elaborate a little bit more, just so we get a good idea of where you're coming from?
Well, when trying to make sense of the confusion and bizarreness of politics in the United States, it's worth going back half a century to look at what President Kennedy was trying to do when he was removed from office. He had called for an end to the nuclear arms race and converting the military war machine towards peaceful purposes. It was perhaps the primary motivation for his removal from office in Dallas. And it's worth asking, what would the 1960s have been if the Cold War had ended, if the war on Vietnam had been stopped, and we had used the resources for destruction for creative, peaceful purposes? We could have many discussions about that. But the bottom line is that was a tipping point in the evolution of the United States as a society with grave consequences for the rest of the world.
Mm. And the 60s did end up being a very turbulent period. I just wanted to, we saw not just John F. Kennedy, but the assassinations of Martin Luther King and the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And
Malcolm X,
yes, and of course, I certainly you, as well documented on your website, and certainly a lot of our listeners would strongly suspect that those were all what they call straight state crimes against democracy. That these were, as you mentioned, an instance of these inconvenient entities being removed from office. So I think that does have some implications for what the politics and what the whole, the spectacle that we're seeing before us, and whether or not a legitimate reformer, anyone who really challenges a system that's corrupt. I mean, the likelihood of that happening through this or any other presidential campaign.
Well, there are many commentators over the years and decades who have observed that to be president of the United States, you have to have proved your loyalty to the empire, and that's true for Democrats as well as Republicans. And the likely nominee on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, the Clintons have a long history of working with the national security state. Some of your listeners may know about Iran-Contra in the 1980s. Some of that happened in Arkansas with the Clintons providing some strategic cover for it. You have Obama with his reasonably well-documented ties to the Central Intelligence Agency as a younger man. So it's not just the Republicans that have this connection. The Democrats, at least the establishment Democrats, have it as well. As far as I know, Bernie Sanders, the challenger on the Democratic side, doesn't have that connection, and therefore is extremely unlikely to be allowed to win the race. Mm-hmm. After watching the election spectacle in my country for three decades, I've come to the conclusion that it's similar to televised wrestling. It's a bruising contest, it's entertaining, but it's rigged in advance. And this particular campaign in 2016 poses even more bizarre aspects of that, at least on the Republican side.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I think that there might be some wrestling fans who would be offended by that comparison, but I was...
Comparing them to politicians, yeah, I know they might be offended.
But Yeah, well, let's you're talking about the Republican situation. I mean, we've got Donald Trump, who appears to be the de facto candidate for the Republicans. I mean, he's certainly doing very well. It's not assured yet, but he seems to have a very strong lead over the other contenders who, frankly, don't seem to be much better. But then again, I don't know how loyal, say, Ted Cruz is to that establishment that you mentioned.
Well, and Cruz is certainly part of the establishment. He's got a bunch of warmongers behind him, but he's more of a fundamentalist religious candidate. The neocons seem to have been circling around John Ellis Bush or Jeb Bush, but his campaign mercifully has gone away, and unless they resurrect him at the convention this summer, we're not going to get another President Bush. Mm-hmm. So we have one thing to be grateful for, at least.
Yeah. One thing about Trump, and then this came up with my earlier conversation with William Bloom, is that he's not getting he's wealthy enough to not have to be at the beck and call of Wall Street. And of course, he's been speaking out consistently against these free trade agreements it seems to me the establishment likes to keep in place, and even has been, not as it's not a given that he's going to be hostile toward Putin the way it seems. The mainstream media, it's given all the messaging we seem to be hearing, it's all like if you're not critical of Putin and calling him some sort of a fascist dictator, well, there's got to be you can't be president. There's something wrong with you.
Well, when Obama was running for president 8 years ago, he was also making critical comments about free trade, and one of his aides was caught telling a group of Canadian leaders that it was just an act and to ignore the speeches, and Obama was solidly on board with it. Bill Clinton did the same thing in 1992, saying that free trade agreements were a disaster, and then he went on to sign the NAFTA treaty. So what Trump actually believes as opposed to what he says, is anybody's guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he's pushing for a very aggressive military escalation in the Middle East. So on some of the imperial orthodoxies, he has perhaps better points of view than Hillary Clinton. There are some ways he's actually even more dangerous.
We've heard of his what he said about Muslims and about walls and about torture.
Right.
So, those things.
And bombing Syria and a bunch of other things.
Mm-hmm.
The real question is, with Hillary Clinton, it's pretty clear what the interests are behind her. But given Trump's incredible rise and given how the media gives him so much attention, what would be interesting to see in the next few months is what are the forces that are actually behind the rise of Donald Trump? It can't just be his organization or his speeches. There must be a bit more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, what about Bernie then? Bernie Sanders. It's not looking good for him at this point. But I mean, you never know. But I'm kind of wondering. I guess maybe in as we look back over the course of this campaign, looking at the situation from the perspective of deep politics, do you have a sense of where Bernie fits into this campaign? I mean, I've heard it suggested, I believe it was Bruce Dixon of Black Agenda Report who called him, basically saying that he's sort of serving the role of sort of capturing, basically granting some legitimacy in the end to the Hillary Clinton campaign, because when he loses, then all of these people who've been following his campaign that he's brought in, people who may not even have been involved in the Democratic Party, then would end up essentially being, because made it clear that should he lose, that he would be backing Hillary.
I think what Dixon called him was a sheepdog for
the Clinton
campaign.
Yeah.
And that seems to be pretty clear. Now, not everybody who is supporting Bernie Sanders is going to automatically vote for Hillary. But having Donald Trump out there as the opposition is going to scare a lot of people into holding their nose. And one of the problems we have is we don't have a parliamentary system like you do in Canada. So a Green Party or a New Democratic Party or something like that, even if they get a few percent of the votes here, doesn't really go anywhere. But the real control, the real way to rig the election is through the media coverage. And Bernie has not gotten that much good press. He's gotten more since he's actually won some states. But Hillary is, of course, the choice of nearly all of the media, and the stories reflect that.
What? I mean, just to assume, like, let's say you suppose that Bernie was able, because he has done astonishing well in spite of the media coverage you allude to. What if he were to somehow climb past Hillary in delegates? What if he were to prevail? I mean, is that – how would you see things playing out in that instance if it was, say, a Bernie versus Trump campaign?
Well
– or have you pretty much ruled out that possibility?
Considering how loyal the Clintons have been for the empire for decades, I think the odds of that are pretty low. I mean, my candidate is none of the above at this point. I don't really think that choosing one side or the other really is going to make that much difference at this point. We don't elect the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We don't elect the directors of the spy agencies. We don't elect the heads of the corporations. And anyone in that position is going to have to bow down and do their agenda. Now, the rulers of our country are not all in precise agreement. They have their differences of opinion over how to manage the empire, just as any other group of people have differences over how to do things. But obviously I would rather have Sanders and Clinton, but I don't think the odds of that are very high.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm just kind of wanting to explore this idea of good people. I mean, not everybody in politics is corrupt, or at least not everybody goes in corrupt. There are people who genuinely seek to, you know, create a better communities, better countries. I tend to believe that, but because of the nature of the system, they end up kind of getting weeded out along the way. And you mentioned one instrument being the media. There's the role of money in terms of organizing people. But I'm wondering if we could just sort of maybe reflect on some of the various mechanisms by which people end up getting weeded out. What would stop a genuine person? I mean,
The candidate I voted for in 2008, Cynthia McKinney, she had been a six-term member of Congress from Georgia, and she was forced out by her fellow Democrats for standing up to the Bush administration. She introduced a resolution to impeach Bush, and so the Democrats ran a moderate challenger against her, and after a couple times succeeded in throwing her out of Congress. There was also Dennis Kucinich from Cleveland, who was also in Congress, and the Democrats redistricted him, and he lost his seat as a result of that, too. There's many tactics to do that with. There's bad media coverage. There's pressure, money coming in to challenge. The list of options for the system are many. But part of the problem also is that the whole binary approach that you have to have one side or the other limits a range of broader possibilities that we could have if we were thinking more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why do we have to choose between lethal injection or the electric chairs? Certainly there are other options that we could have in our world. It's a little better in Canada with your parliamentary system, but even there, the scale of what we need to keep the Earth viable and to turn off the global war system so that we can use the resources for our collective survival, that's not really in the political system almost anywhere.
Hmm. Yeah, and I guess, you know, one more mechanism, you know, it would be what happened to Robert Kennedy. He was in Bernie's shoes, you might say. Seems somewhat similar there. And he ended up being assassinated late, I guess, toward the end of the campaign, but before all of the primaries were completed, if I'm not mistaken.
He was killed immediately after he won the California primary, where it became obvious that he was going to become the candidate of the Democratic Party and likely would have defeated Richard Nixon in the general election. So, but he was actually, from a stronger point of view, than Bernie Sanders. He had a better view on peace, and he was also even more popular than Sanders. And if he had been allowed to live, it's very likely he would have become president. And it's well established at this point that Senator Robert Kennedy was interested in reopening the investigation of what was done to his brother. And that was, of course, too dangerous for the system to allow.
You know, you were talking about the differences between the two major parties as the difference between death by lethal injection and death by the electric chair. I'm reminded of an allegory by a figure that actually appears fairly prominently on your site, Mike Rupert. He compared it to the two rival crime families, the Genoveses and the Gambinos. I don't know. That sound. I find that's a kind of a compelling. Comparison there, they're running basically on behalf, the two parties are representing these elite economic interests that are not necessarily in line with those of regular working people or the environment.
Well, and seeing Sanders do relatively well and seeing Trump essentially take over the Republican Party suggests that there's a lot of grassroots dissatisfaction on both sides. It's a bit confused. It's not quite as focused as it could be, but you have a lot of Democrats who are not at all happy that Hillary is going to be anointed their leader. And on the Republican side, there's a lot of dissatisfaction of the Republican establishment that takes their base for granted. But having said that, the idea of Donald Trump being the answer is, kind of a bad joke.
Mm-hmm.
But it shows that we're in the middle of a huge shakeup in politics, and where this is going, there's far too many variables for anyone really to know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can even offer a best guess. I hear, for one thing, that there's a large contingent of the Sanders movement that they ain't going to vote for Hillary. They're going to go with Jill Stein of the Greens and or the Green Party, and that would also introduce that element there. It makes me wonder then what your thoughts are about the Sanders movement, irrespective of what Bernie himself could do, the movement behind him and the potential there.
Well, I think back to Ralph Nader when he ran in 2000, where you had a lot of Nader voters who said there's no way they're going to vote for Gore. And then when it came actually time to go and vote, half of them actually did vote for Gore, and the other half, such as myself, stayed with Ralph Nader. And I suspect something similar will happen, especially if Trump is the opposition to Hillary Clinton. You'll have a lot of people who will hold their nose and vote for Hillary as the lesser of evils, and you'll have other people who might choose Trump, and you'll have a lot of people who won't know what to do.
And you've just reminded me, when you brought up the Gore-Nader issue, that in 2000, that was basically, Nader getting the blame, but a huge factor there was also the vote rigging. The number of people who would normally vote Democrat being just left off the ballot, and how the Democratic Party to this day hasn't really addressed that, nor have they addressed the whole issue of these voting machines, the Diebold machines that are not exactly reliable in terms of turning out authentic results.
Well, because their 2004 for our presidential race was even more rigged than 2000 in Florida. You had several states that were flipped. John Kerry clearly won, but he stood down. It's also been used in a number of congressional races, and it can be used by both parties. It's not only the Republicans who rig votes. And the idea that we actually trust software companies with secret software to count our ballots in private, the fact that that's not an enormous scandal, that that's been allowed to happen through public apathy, it's incredible.
Your guest, yeah. So would you say then that, well, first, I mean, as far as the vote rigging is going, are we seeing any evidence of that in these primaries?
I've heard rumors of it, but frankly, I'm not really following it, because my guess is Sanders is probably a lot more popular than the Democratic establishment ever bargained for. But with superdelegates and media coverage and other forms of manipulation, I'll be extremely surprised if Hillary Clinton is not the nominee. And on the Republican side, the Republicans are sort of all, you know, they're even floating the idea of finding some third party to, or changing who gets to run at the convention this summer to keep Trump out, because their polling shows that Hillary Clinton, or Bernie Sanders for that matter, would clearly beat Trump. And you have big donors to the Republican Party now who are worried it's going to damage their control of Congress and local races. And, you know, the Democrats of today are like the Republicans of yesterday, and the Republicans of today are more like the John Birch Society of yesterday. And plus you have all the extreme right-wing white supremacist types who are coming into the Trump campaign, and that is probably scarier than anything, because they didn't rise up through the electoral system, and it's not going to be going away after the election, even if Hillary, or even if Bernie Sanders, for that matter, is the winner.
Now, your website, oilempire.us, it focuses on a number of issues, but it basically connects all of those dots of peak oil and climate change and 9/11 and you know, presidential politics. It's quite a treasure trove. I've been reading it for years now, and I guess I'm wanting to know, in light of this conversation, how you see peak oil and climate change and environmental and economic collapse, which appear to be underway. How do you see them impacting the politics? Are there any clear signatures as you watch this campaign?
I think Trump is the biggest signature of it at all, because a number of years ago I heard a presentation from the author Richard Hindberg, who suggested that energy decline and ecological decline would be seen for their symptoms rather than their causes. So people would see the start of the decline of energy as looking like a recession that kept going on until it became a depression. And we're starting to see signs of that with the decline of conventional oil, the rise of tar sands in Canada and fracking in the United States. But as it becomes more difficult to maintain the growth that industrial society has developed, you're going to see a lot of people hurting from the consequences economically. And when economic circumstances decline for large societies, that is fertile ground for demagogues of all types, with the classic example being Germany in 1929. Now, there's a lot of differences for what we're experiencing from that example, but the rise of Trump, basically saying it's all somebody else's fault, I see that accelerating, and I see Trump, you know, paving the way for far more demagogues in the future rather than less.
But do you see that that peaking in this willingness to, you know, point to other people as the reason for their problems?
I would hope that we could get to peak blame, but My guess is we're nowhere near that, and I really hope to be wrong on that. The antidote to the blame is for communities to take responsibility to relocalize production, to relocalize food production, to have community economies that are focused on regionalism instead of globalism, to take responsibility for helping to pilot the spaceship Earth that we all live on together. The more that communities are more locally resilient, the more insulated we will be from these types of demagoguery that threaten to disrupt social cohesion.
Mm. Yeah,
and that's true in Canada, that's true in Europe, that's true in Asia, it's true anywhere, because these are going to be issues that affect all of us.
Is there anything more you can say in terms? I mean, as we see these developments, not just politically, of course, but the wider environmental crises that are taking place. What more do we need to do? To kind of, not just survive, but hopefully reverse the tide on this precipice that we seem to be headed towards.
Well, part of it is to recognize that we are at peak everything. We're not just at peak energy. We're at peak communication, peak culture, peak knowledge. And we know how to reverse a lot of ecological destruction. We know how to grow food without destroying the planet. We know how to use much less energy and live well. But it's as much of a cultural problem as a political or financial problem. We have to see the world is interconnected in a good way. There's globalism of transnational corporations and militaries. There's also globalism of realizing that we're all human beings on the planet together, and we're all going to sink or swim together. We've used half the oil. How do we want to use the other half? Do we want to use it to build a world where we can take care of each other, or to have endless war fighting over what's left? That's essentially part of the choice that we face.
No. On that note, I'm afraid I have to leave you now, but I really enjoyed speaking with you, Mark. It's been a great pleasure, and kudos on your website and on your upcoming book. When is it being released soon?
It's going to be after the election. I think that's probably a better timing for it.
Okay.
But you can follow it at peakchoice.org and the electoral materials at www.oilempire.us.
Okay. Mark Rabinowitz, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you again.
I've been speaking with Mark Rabinowitz. He is the publisher of oilempire.us and a writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.